from the top. Can we start? It doesn't look like we are expecting any more people to join. Babado, can we start?
Okay, just before I hand over to you, Chairperson, I just want to check if my colleagues are here. Elizabeth, are you on the platform? Elizabeth, Equal Education. Rachel, Alta,
Matthew's only, I think he's the only one here.
Okay, Chairperson, since he's here, you can start and then you can play around with your agenda, Chair, and deal with the present stakeholders, Chairperson. You have more than enough. We have more than enough members. I've counted six members who are on the platform. Over to you, Chairperson. Okay.
But can you check those who are supposed to make presentations now, telephonically?
We'll do that, Chairperson, in the background.
Matthew, are you on the platform?
I think they are on the platform now, except Equal Education, Chairperson. I see
that. Why can't I hear them?
Okay, you can invite them, Chairperson, to say a word. Over to you, Chair. Thank you.
Let me first start by officially opening the meeting and welcome all the members who are on the platform. And welcome the participant for prioritizing this very important part of our process in processing the bills. Public participation, it's very important that we hear from you. And I want to believe that there are members from National Treasury. As and when you submit, they'll be here to hear what you're saying together with our honorable members. The support staff, I think they're all here. You're all welcome. The meeting is officially opened and felt free, but I'm also going to request that we stick to the time because our agenda is very congested. I did make some arrangements which are not confirmed, but please let's try to stick to the minutes allocated. So on the agenda, we're going to deal with two bills: appropriation bill and the ESCOM debt relief bill. Usually we request that we open our videos, but like I said, I always try to set the example. My signal is very weak, hence I cannot open the video because that's how we are trying to manage. We are advised by the people in the IT that if that's the case, then you must close the video. So my signal is very weak. It was yellowish and sending me messages. You are all welcome, members and colleagues, and the media who are in the platform and all the stakeholders. Do we have apologies?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson, and the honorable members and colleagues present on the platform. Chairperson, from the committee, we have two apologies. The apology of Mr. Karim and Mr. Ryder. Those are the only two apologies that we received. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm aware of the two I've seen, those two apologies. It's Honorable Zita Ngeta. The platform, or did you receive any apology from her on Kiva, Eastern Cape?
No, Chairperson, they are not on the platform yet.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I hope they'll join as and when we go on with our meeting. And Honorable Mama Rakhana, no, she's not well, but she didn't indicate that she will not be part of the meeting today. I don't know if she's on the platform or she's still not well.
She's present, Chairperson.
Okay. Welcome, Beke. Honorable Mamadkhane, and we hope you recover speedily. Wasikhaya, siyafana nami, ngiyaphethe. Lubabalo, you do know who is, I heard you calling the name of Elizabeth. I don't know if this is the person who's going to make a presentation on behalf of Equal Education. Is she here?
Good morning. Yes, I am, Honorable Member.
Okay. Okay, you can kickstart the presentation. You allocated 15 minutes, madam.
All right. Thank you, ma'am. Good morning, Honorable Members and other colleagues that have joined. I am presenting this submission on behalf of Equal Education, a Democratic member organization of made up of learners, teachers, parents, and post-school youth that is fighting for equal and quality education in the South Africa system. And just before I even go into the meaty part of the presentation, please note I'm not an economist, and so I am here to give an education-centered, both from a legal and a social perspective of how the budget or the allocations impact learners and school communities. So at the onset, we would like to establish the context in which we are making this submission. And I would believe members in this committee are aware, either from their lived experiences or the various news articles, that we have an education or a schooling system that is in crisis at the moment. And that crisis is multifold. We've got the learning crisis, infrastructure crisis. The sector is plagued by spending and governance challenges that we are saying that it is leading to an education blackout. So if we pick an example of one of these crises and we zoom in and we use infrastructure, the infrastructure crisis to make the point or the argument that we want to highlight this morning, we see that a significant proportion of our public schools do not have the bare minimum or the basics to function as they should. We've got about 3,000 odd schools that are still made of inappropriate material. We've got over 13,000 schools that are in need of sanitation, upgrade, or intervention.
Sorry, madam, you have the co-host, right? Can you share the slide?
Oh, okay.
It's blank. I don't know if it's only from my side, but we can't see your presentation.
All right, so I'm logged onto my phone. I will have to change devices for that. But I will present.
Lubabalo, can't you help? Can't we request Lubabalo to help? Because if you are going to wait for you to change, it might take time. Can you help?
Yes, Chairperson, I'm ready to help.
Must I
use the submission that you sent to us, or you have a different document?
Okay, I made a short presentation so that it goes quicker. I'm just going to forward it to you. But it's not, what you call it, it's not a big issue, it's not a case much. So, Honorable Chair, can I continue while I email him the PowerPoint I am presenting from?
Yes, and immediately you see the presentation on the screen, please indicate to him on which slide are you.
Where I am talking from. Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Yeah.
So we've got significant infrastructure challenges that do not actually create conducive teaching and learning environments for our children. Our classrooms are overcrowded. Our learners do not have appropriate access to water and sanitation like they should. And we have challenges with water supply. And according to the Department of Basic Education, there would need significant amounts of financial investment to address some of these critical infrastructure backlogs that I have highlighted here. For example, the department claims it would need about over 44 billion rands to address the overcrowding challenges in our public schools. Similarly, they highlight that about 17 billion rand will be needed to address sanitation challenges or upgrades in our public schools. So when we look at these challenges, we see that these historical backlogs are severe and require substantial investments in terms of budget allocations or monies to address these problems. So what then does this mean? Ending this blackout that I have highlighted, I'm sure members will also be aware from last week's launch or release of the 2021 international reading results and the PIRLS results. 81% of our learners cannot read for meaning. So the severe challenges in our sector is quite great and it is impacting learners' futures. So when we say we want to end the education blackout and realize quality schooling, we cannot do that without adequate funding for basic education, for the national and education departments, and even schools themselves. So what we need to do is to ensure that the adequate funding to the sector is realized so that the funding is keeping up with inflation and learner enrollment and changing, you know, systems in the education system, the price of providing goods and services are realized. So the 2023 budgets that we have seen, the allocations to the sector, in our opinion, does not meet this criteria of keeping up with inflation and also considering the learner enrollment aspect. And so although the budget itself has seen quite a substantial amount of money, nearly a billion rand added to the projections we saw in in last year's NTF projections. So what we are saying this morning, excuse me, is that education funding must keep up with inflation and consider the learner enrollment for us to be able to see real changes in the the Eastern Cape, the system is very slow as well. For us to be able to see any meaningful changes in the sector. So when we look at the allocations for this year, this financial year, we see that there's a real real decrease of 2.6%. That's if you take into consideration a critical issue like inflation. So if we take inflation into account, we see that the budget or the allocation itself is 2.6% lower than the 2023 MTEF projected decrease of 1.7%, which is a troubling scenario because things are still getting more expensive, and yet the money is not keeping up with inflation. Sorry, I've emailed the presentation. Hopefully it's gotten to Honorable Ndoda. So the decrease in real terms in terms of the money that we are talking about is not anything new for us, right? It is a continuation of existing trends in the sector funding. And this decrease in real trends, so money, so allocation not keeping up with inflation, actually has very dire consequences or negative impact on learners and school communities themselves. So it means that the per learner spending for this year is considerably lower than it was for the last financial year. It means that what our monies can buy for the goods and services for teaching and learning will be impacted. And so we need to consider how the allocation really does, or the impact it has in the lived experience of learners and communities. When we look specifically at a critical conditional grant like the infrastructure funding, the education infrastructure funding, we have seen some positive news in this financial year in that $1.5 billion has been allocated or given to address overcrowding over the next 3 years. And we saw an additional $283 million to assist in repairing damaged schools both in the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal. So this additional money means that infrastructure funding will grow this year by 2.5% in real time. So it will be keeping, in fact, it will be above the inflationary rates if we consider all these additional funds. And this is a great and positive thing to highlight. However, the trend in infrastructure funding does not keep up or does not continue after this year. So there's a volatility over the medium term. And we see, like, for the next financial year, the 2024-25 financial year, we see a drastic decrease to by 4.3%, which means that the gains that we have made or we have had this year will totally be wiped out, and we'll be back to in a place that was even worse than the last financial year. This is problematic for us because, this means that we are not really addressing or tackling the issue from the ground. We are basically just, the budget is seemingly reactive to the challenges of the sector and not actually proactive in addressing some of these challenges. All this thing being said, we are also of the view that enough funding is only one part of the solution to fix the education blackout or the challenges in the sector. There are also serious issues with the way that education departments spend their money. And this has great impact on how we're able to solve the current crisis and also to provide quality and equal education to our learners. So funding alone is only one part to the current crisis. The sector, from the very top, the National Department of Education, to the very bottom, suffers from what we call endemic spending issues. We've got issues of underspending, irregular expenditure, fruitless, and so I am on slide 8, honorable members, sorry about this. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure. I need not remind honorable members here of all the scandals that come every now and then in media reports of people siphoning money, misdirecting funds that are meant to go to provision of education resources and keep using it for their own personal means, or flashing it away through some dubious means. So the corruption in the sector is not new. It's not something that I must belabor the point. We are well aware of it. And the Auditor General's reports are always damning of this sector, because the issues, the spending issues that is not, is across the board government, is more pronounced in this sector than any other department. So we need to look at it and consider this aspect as well. So what we are saying is that the state of our schools will be drastically improved if education departments actually spend properly, wisely, judicially, and actually manage their finances properly, so that we are able to see improved experiences or improved outcomes in the sector. In slide 9, we take time to highlight the part that this honorable select committee and, in fact, all oversight bodies, including National Treasury, can take in addressing or in helping us to address this education blackout that we have highlighted, and we want the budget to assist in addressing. So firstly, and quite the takeaway message is that we need to acknowledge the education blackout and the challenges in this sector, and take it as seriously as we have taken the Eskom energy crisis and how we are moving towards addressing it. So the education blackout is real. It is dimming the future, the light and the future of our learners. If we do not address it soon, it will be in total darkness. And to ensure schools get the money needed to tackle these challenges, to end the education blackout, there's a role for you, honorable members, and for oversight, other oversight bodies, to ensure that this happens successfully and efficiently. We therefore call on the committee to reject the 2023 budget, the allocations, and to actually ask for the budget for schooling, ask for a budget for schooling that grows in line with inflation and learner enrollment. So we're asking the committee to ask for adjustments or changes to the 2023 budget that actually considers key and critical issues like the increase in goods and services inflation and the increase in learner enrollment, so that the money is not just looking like it's a big sum, but when we take all these issues into account, it is actually addressing the issues, or it is enough to address the current issues that we've highlighted in the sector. We also employed this honorable committee to take its oversight responsibility as seriously as it does with other sectors. We ask you to actively engage the department on how it spends its monies, and also apply proper consequence management for any deviation from the way that they have really committed to spending their money. So we want proper consequence management for issues like underspending, issues like irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditures, while infrastructure backlogs are growing, while our learners are struggling to read for meaning, while there's a plethora of issues that we need to address to ensure that indeed the education that we are providing is preparing our learners for the future and to develop themselves personally. And we also ask the Honorable Committee to ensure that proper oversight is provided if and when the norms and standards are brought to Parliament for amendment. So some of the issues that we have highlighted this morning that is really leading to an education blackout, actually it's in law. There's a legal framework to address them, but we are seeing an education department that is increasingly trying to shy away from its legal responsibility. And they are amending the norms and standards for public school infrastructure to be able to avoid providing the necessary support to school communities, especially schools in rural provinces that serve mostly Black learners. This is unacceptable and it should not be able to stand. So we are calling on all of you, including National Treasury, to acknowledge this blackout in our school, provide the needed money and oversight to ensure our learners' futures are indeed bright. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. and I'm hoping that members have taken notes. We now go to the second presentation, which is a public service accountability monitor. Also, 15 minutes. Do you have Sharon Rice? Do you have new documents? And I hope these new documents are a summary of the actual document, because we can't receive and prepare on a document, and then when you come to present, you present something different. I hope on that score we understand each other. Okay, the presentation is on the screen. Over to you, Public Service Accountability Monitor.
Thank you very much. Just checking that I am audible.
Oh, thank you.
Great. All right. Thanks. Good morning, Chair and honourable members of the committee, presenters and other stakeholders present today. My name is Lisa Higginson, and I'm the Budget Advocacy Coordinator at PSAN, Public Service Accountability Monitor. This is my first time presenting to the committee, but PSAN has made numerous submissions in the past. And for those who don't know us, PSAN forms part of the School of Journalism and Media Studies at Rhodes University in Makanda, UK. Our activities include research, monitoring, advocacy and capacity building focused on addressing societal problems originating from systemic public resource management failures. We welcome this opportunity to make our submission on the 2023 Appropriation Bill. Our submission focuses on the resourcing of South African anti-corruption system. We had anticipated that this would be a joint sitting, so we must mention up front that our analysis is focused on national departments and entities and not on the provincial transfers and specific regional programs. However, we recognize that corruption and its impacts has... that these impacts cut across every facet of the public service. So we sort of started from the NDP goal for a South Africa that has zero tolerance for corruption, recognizing that fighting corruption requires an anti-corruption system that is well-resourced, free from political interference, and has the support of citizens. So the structure of our presentation today, we'll be looking briefly at the key frameworks, anti-corruption frameworks, briefly look at the performance and resourcing of key departments and entities. We'll briefly discuss coordination, we'll make our conclusion, and then put forward our summary and summary of findings and recommendations. The slides include the graphs of historical spending and the MTF allocation, although they won't be discussed as part of the presentation, just in the interest of time. But they're included there just for reference. So we looked at three frameworks. We recognise that, you know, corruption cuts across. There are various frameworks and strategies across different departments, and this has been a topic of interest and discussion for some time. There are also some older strategies and policies that we won't discuss. So we look at the National Anti-Corruption Strategy as the sort of overarching anti-corruption framework. And we see this as emerging from the NDP. The process, we believe, was initiated in 2018 and the draft was published in 2020. We've also included briefly a consideration of the Procurement Bill and the Zonda recommendations on procurement, recognizing that the role of procurement and weak procurement systems in enabling state capture and the impact and implications of corruption and maladministration in procurement systems, how this affects service delivery, how it affects democracy, how it affects our lived experience, and what efforts are underway to try and address these. From what we can tell, there isn't currently a single funding framework for the anti-corruption strategy. There is mention of an implementation plan, and we understand that there is an interim body that is essentially working on it. But as far as we can tell, there isn't a clear single document where we can see what resources are required to fight corruption. Sorry, I didn't mention there, just, you know, I suppose it's from the slides, just about the procurement bill. We emphasized some of the dates here just to show that a number of these efforts have been underway for some time. And I think, like probably many in this committee and other South Africans, we are concerned at how long these processes are taking, given the urgency of these matters. As I said, we looked at a selection of departments and entities that we thought were largely responsible for implementing some of these planned strategies and efforts. So we looked here at the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, the Special Investigating Unit, the SIU, the NPA, and we looked briefly at the FIC, SARS, and the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, more as they relate to procurement. We recognize that there are a number of other stakeholders. There are probably some departments that we've left out, but this is a start for us to understand what the resourcing and performance looks like and what needs to be done. So we note that the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, their budget has remained relatively flat, with a slight decline in real terms. We recognize that, you know, although this, if they have a broad mandate that goes beyond what we are talking about today, they play a key oversight role in the operations of these key entities that we're looking at. And the NPA, SIU, Public Protector, and the Human Rights Commission are located within this department. And we were concerned to find in the most recent annual report serious challenges highlighted around financial management and internal controls, resulting in 900 million rands of irregular expenditure in 21-22, and weak supply chain management and recruitment processes, leading to underspending of 600 million rand in 21-22. We also note that the SIU, as you mentioned, as an entity within this department, has been given a mandate to investigate transactions taking place between 2012 and 2018. And that the department currently owes the SIU somewhere in the region of about 70 million for previous investigations that they have not paid to date. So we question what impact this has on the entities, recognizing that there's likely a need for sign-off and various other factors in undertaking their work. We looked at the NPA. This is one of the main programs in the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, receiving, when you said correctly, about 23% of the budget. We note that, you know, overall, if you look at the graphs, again, funding has remained relatively flat. However, we do note that additional funds we received in 2019, and these were used to fill critical vacancies, including some prosecutor positions, and this has helped to rebuild capacity. However, challenges remain, and some of the performance metrics, you know, don't necessarily line up with these additional resources. And we note that poor uptake of the SIU referrals, which we'll discuss briefly later, was also partly attributed to capacity constraints. So we note that an additional 1.3 billion has been allocated to the NPA over the medium-term expenditure framework, and we request, you know, we'd like to reiterate that these additional funds need to be followed by improved performance and improved outcomes. Looking at the SIU, the Special Investigating Unit, they've seen a number of adjustments to spending since 2012. It's not as smooth as some of the other departments, and you know, we question what impact this has on their operations and their ability to fulfill their mandate. But we also note that the department only receives a portion of their funding from the fiscus, and the balance is made up of revenue from services rendered, creating an inherent conflict in the funding model, and this has been raised in the past. They've performed relatively well, achieving 100% of their targets in 2021-22, which is an increase from the previous year. But again, in terms of the funding model, I can't remember offhand what the current figure is, but they're currently owed, I think, somewhere in the region of about R1 billion from various departments who they've investigated and who have not paid for the services. We look briefly at the Public Protector and the Human Rights Commission, given that they play quite an important role in the anti-corruption system and particularly engaging with citizens. We found that the Public Protector receives quite a small share of the budget, and the allocations haven't really increased in real terms, despite an increase in their mandate to include more anti-corruption efforts and whistleblower management. We also noted recently that very few of the recommendations have been implemented, and from the annual reports, we also see that very few of the complex cases are being finalized, and the performance, the improved performance is often related to simpler cases. Human Rights Commission also receives a small share of the budget and supports citizens. The budget has actually decreased in real terms in recent years, and a number of challenges have been highlighted in the Commission that could have performance. We think it is important that these two entities are adequately funded and that their efforts and their recommendations are implemented to ensure that citizens are protected and their issues are addressed. As I said, we look briefly at the FIC, that's the Financial Intelligence Commission, SARS Operations, and the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, falling under National Treasury. And we are encouraged to see that both the Chief Procurement Officer and the FIC have received quite significant real increases over the intake, which should translate into better outcomes. We believe some of the increased allocations to the FIC are largely attributed to the FATF recommendations, and the recognition of the link between corruption and complex financial crimes, including money laundering and terrorist financing. The SARS operation budget also has been relatively inconsistent with frequent changes. However, the recent increases appear to coincide with better revenue collection and more attention to supporting anti-corruption, as reflected in newly introduced performance measures that link to NPA referrals, as an example. I mentioned briefly before that coordination is key. There are a number of stakeholders that are involved in anti-corruption measures. We've looked at just a few. There are others: local governments, SACs, non-state actors, and various others. And we recognize that the NACAC, which is the anti-corruption coordinating, sorry, but this was established as part of the National Anti-Corruption Strategy. It's an interim body, and they are playing some coordination role, but there's also the Anti-Corruption Task Team, which consists mainly of enforcement, but also has a mandate that it's implementing, and it's not absolutely clear to us how they are working together and where their mandates overlap. There have also been recent revelations of coordination between the SIU and the NPA, where very few of the cases referred are prosecuted. Based on the presentation there, there was a commitment to signing a new MOU between the various entities. So this, you know, is kind of a third coordinating mechanism. Again, unclear of how this adds or works within the existing structures. It's less clear how the procurement reforms are coordinated and how they are integrated into the anti-corruption system. In conclusion, we recognize we haven't gone into great detail the impact of corruption. As I've said, this is becoming quite well known. It impacts democracy, service delivery, social and economic development, investor confidence and public trust, and really poses a threat to any of our social development objectives. This, therefore, we believe that anti-corruption should be a priority. And although frameworks have been developed and institutions are established, the progress has been quite slow, and they need to be adequately resourced. And to that end, we believe that there should be an integrated framework showing how they all link together, so that we can hold them accountable. So while we welcome the additional resources, we recognise that more needs to be done, particularly in terms of coordination across entities. A few of the more specific findings, there are only five of them, so I'll be quick in my last minute. The challenges with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, we'd like to encourage the committee to interrogate further with the department and ensure measures are in place to resolve these issues. And a further recommendation would be to explore the possibility of reallocating funds within the board to ensure adequate funding of the anti-corruption system, recognising that there may be some areas in the department that are not spending their allocated funds, and these could be allocated elsewhere where they would be better used. Excuse me. The next is that the increased allocations to the NPA, we recognise this has enabled them to take steps to rebuild capacity, but we recommend that the committee review past performance and ensure that the outlook and the NTEP performance targets are in line with the additional allocations provided. There's also some concerns about funding for the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council that I mentioned earlier. It appears to be funded from the Criminal Asset Recovery Account. It's unclear how the money is spent or how it's allocated. And given the important role that they play, we think that they should receive adequate funding, and this should possibly come from the central fiscus to ensure sustainability. The last is just given the numerous stakeholders involved in anti-corruption efforts, it is really critical that these entities work together to ensure the efficient use of scarce resources and to secure better outcomes, restoring trust in the public service. And to this end, we urge the committee to follow up to find out whether the MOU has been concluded and to find out how the various existing coordinating structures are working together themselves. That brings me to the end of the presentation. Sorry, 1 minute over. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Very helpful and the presentation is empowering us and also giving suggestion. I like it when you highlight issues and give recommendations, suggestions on how do you think we can resolve or we can intervene in as far as these issues. Not really saying we will be able to do it to win what you are requesting, but I'm happy that the Treasury is here. Thank you very much for that presentation. Auta, over to you.
Thank you so much, honourable members. And from our side, I would like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to make this presentation. Allow me to share my screen. Okay, so this presentation is made on behalf of the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. Once again, we would like to thank you for the opportunity to present to the select committee. We also wish to emphasize that we equally value public participation, especially when it is championed by Parliament. So ALTA, as you can see, we are a non-profit civil action organization, and we do look at issues when there's concerning any corruption or maladministration in the use of funds. So we also rely on public funding to do our work and then to hold those to account, which is once again a value that we appreciate of Parliament in their role to hold the executive to account. Our submission specifically focused on vote 5 of Home Affairs in the Appropriations Bill, that is on page 7. Our interest therein lies look in the funding provisions made to the Represented Political Party Fund, and then how that also then speaks and impacts on the Independent Electoral Commission. We want to state it very clearly that as ALTA, we are not opposed or against to any political party funding. We firmly believe that any party funding is necessary to ensure a functioning democracy. However, we have concerns that while political party funding is being contributed to from the fiscus, the IEC is being weakened. And the IEC is predominantly one of the only oversight authorities that do consider how political party funds are being spent and applied, together with the political party's own auditing processes. We're also very much aware that the Independent Electoral Commission is currently facing additional responsibilities. This we can see in the wake of the newly gazetted and Electoral Amendment Act of 2023, the Political Party Funding Act of 2021, and next year's national and provincial elections. Our concerns then specifically look at the annual increases to represent a Political Party Funding Act, the budget cuts experienced by the IEC, and then once again the impact of the elections. We note that approximately 350 million rand has been allocated to the Represented Political Party Funding Act in this year. However, we also note that recently in the second Adjustments Appropriation Act 2 of 2023, the Represented Political Party funding got an additional 300 million rand allocated. We do not see this in isolation. We are aware that though this is one stream of funding to political parties, there is in total 11 other streams that get funding allocated to political parties. These are from Parliament itself, as indicated the RPPF, as well as provincial legislatures. Now, taken into consideration, the total funding then received approximately totals 1.874 billion rand going to political party funding. Conversely, though, the Independent Electoral Commission has been receiving budget cuts totaling 700 million rand over the past 3 years. The most recent example for this next adjustment phase is 251 million rand that has been cut. Now, if we consider the additional funds being given to the Represented Political Party funds, that almost equals what has been cut from the Independent Electoral Commission. We strongly feel that there needs to be increased transparency of political party funding. In the recent reports also made by the information regulator in the process then of requesting PIAs under the Promotion of Access to Information Act to get the disclosures from political parties. These speak to the 11 different public funding streams that I've referred to. And we're also aware through the Political Party Funding Act that considers private donations to political parties. When all these figures are combined, these are staggering amounts, but this is also weakening the Independent Electoral Commission if in their budgets they do not get additional support. So as a Chapter 9 Institute, the IEC has got numerous obligations. These include, as you can see, to manage elections on a national and provincial level, that those elections are free and fair, the results are declared accurately, and then compile and maintain a national common voters roll. Throughout all the recent disclosures and media attention revolving around the Electoral Amendment Act, we know the IEC is facing severe restraints when it comes to next year's elections. And we kindly request in the consideration of the budget and allocations that instead of cutting the IEC's budget to provide more provision to enable and empower them for our elections next year. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Alta. Very precise, to the point. You have saved us a few minutes. Thank you for that. Comrade Matthew, over to you.
Okay. Well, good morning, Chair. Good morning to all members and colleagues. Thanks for giving us this COSATU chance just to share our views on the appropriation bill. Let me just quickly put up our little presentation. So I think, just to say thanks, Chair, for giving us the space as COSATU just to raise some of the key issues. We just wanted to lift up what we felt were some of the key themes in the appropriation bill. But I think, Chair, I know we'll be correctly accused of being a broken record player, but I think our starting point is COSATU is always about what are the challenges facing, not just the fiscus and the balance sheet, but workers, the economy, society at large. And we are still having an economy which is very fragile, trying to recover from a painful recession, a global pandemic. We have seen a little bit of progress over the past year around unemployment, but it's still very dangerously high at 42.4%. Of course, many workers are really struggling. Many have lost wages, are still losing wages. Workers are really drowning in debt. I think we all know the issues of rapid load shedding, which is crippling the economy, and that has a spiral effect on the fiscus. Of course, the pandemic of cable theft, criminality, which is crippling transit and parcel, which is also sabotaging the economy. And I think we've seen many SOEs in various stages of collapse in ICU. Municipalities are extremely worrying, with 90% now in financial troubles. And a consequence, public services, basic services are really deteriorating. And of course, the issue of corruption, decimating state capacity. So, Chair, I think we had felt really on the budget and appropriation bill, a bit of a more comprehensive focus by government to address the multiple crises. We don't think it's correct simply just to focus on reducing the debt levels. And yes, we need to manage the debt. We can't get out of control, and we are worried about it. But we also need to see how do we grow the economy, because a 0.9% if we're lucky GDP growth this year is a crisis. We should be looking at how to ramp up relief to the unemployed and get them to the labor market. How can we expand public employment programs, stimulate the economy? How do we rebuild the state and the SOEs and municipalities and public services? What more support can we give to SARS in the issue of tax and customs evasion? What more can we do to fight corruption? And I think if we do all of those, Chair, then we would be able to reduce the debt in a more sustainable manner as simply thinking our problem is a fiscal balance sheet. We know, Chair, members would always correctly raise the issue of the wage bill. And again, I think we've been raising for some years the need for government to fix its relationship with public servants to negotiate in good faith, rebuild collective bargaining. I think we saw the strike this year in our hospitals, a painful strike. It's what we've been fearing all these years, that if we don't rebuild the issue of collective bargaining in the state, workers are just going to get very frustrated and things are going to get out of hand. And no one is going to benefit. If you want to rebuild the developmental state to achieve the positive objectives of SONA, we need to have a positive relationship with public servants. They need to be highly motivated. And it's difficult for nurses or cleaners or security guards or teachers who are motivated when they're drowning in debt. The supporting relatives who have lost jobs have seen their wages being slashed. And many public servants, too, are struggling because they've seen below CPI increases for quite a few years now. So real terms, it's a cut. We think, Chair, there is ways to assist the fiscus by having a single wage regime for the entire state, not just the public service, so the other third of the state. Have a single collective bargaining for all spheres of the state. We think, Chair, and we know it's a sensitive point for members, but we think in terms of the members of cabinet, provincial executive councils, senior management, the entities, etc., there is some space and a need to reduce their packages, or even just for political symbolism and so forth. We think, Chair, there is space to do further headcounts for ghost powers, especially in some of our former homeland areas where we think there is significant padding. Chair, I think on the issue of SARS, we really want to say, if you want to say, have an example of why it's positive to invest in public services, SARS is that example. The additional allocation given to SARS to appoint additional about 500 staff, there's further allocation in the appropriation bill, and also investing in IT capacity, that's yielded huge positive benefits for society, with SARS exceeding the revenue collection target by 94 billion rand. And again, so we think SARS is a win-win investment for the state. We should be empowering to do livestock audits of the wealthy, examining further tax loopholes. We think we should be looking at utilizing retiring Defense Force personnel, the presidential employment stimulus to help reinforce SARS on the customs front. We do need to have a discussion, Chair, if we want to give relief to the economy, about a similar approach to overhauling the Rolex and fund, which continues to be a burden to everybody, including workers. We think there is a space for some discussion about increasing taxes upon the wealthy and giving space to protect lower middle income earners more. Chair, on the economic and social front of the appropriation bill, so we really want to welcome the extension of the SOD grant. It has been a huge poverty relief mechanism, a positive story for the government. But we're quite worried, Chair, that it has not been adjusted for CPI since 2020. So the value of the 350 is significantly being eroded. Also, Chair, we see the allocation being given to it are continuously declining as the upcase declines. We think, Chair, we should be seeing how do we deal with administrative glitches, how can it relate to the food poverty line, link it to skills and jobs programs, but we should be extending it and not kind of, you know, downscaling it. I think what's even more worrying for us, Chair, is the presidential employment program, which has been very positive. It's up, so far had an uptake of about 1 million participants, mostly young people. Last year, October, it was cut from, you know, 24 to 18 billion rand, and the February budget, it was cut further to 9.4 billion rand, and then government plans to end it by the end of this financial year. And to us, Chair, that's political madness when you have an unemployment rate of 12 million people, especially amongst young people. This has been a very positive way to get young people into the labor market, give them practical skills and experience and training. We can't understand why we're allowing a huge poverty and unemployment relief program to be phased out. I think, Chair, there's one message we could get through today is that we need to extend the presidential plan program and, in fact, to enhance it to take on board at least 1 million, if not 2 million active participants by the MTPS. Chair, we have had positive engagement with Treasury on the allowing workers early access to the pension funds. We're hoping to see next month the tax laws amendment bills and in October that would give access to workers from the 1st of March. And I think I mentioned the issue of the fuel price regime, but there is a positive kind of fuel price relief this year on it. Chair, just on the SOEs, I won't go too much into the Eskom debt relief because we have a later presentation on it. But I think we do welcome it, but we think we need to see more support being given to solar panels for SMEs and for RDB homes, but not just those who can afford to invest on their own. I think there is positive allocations to given to rebuilding our railway network. But I think we need to also see the security services assisting as well from the police, defense force, and also to see how can we ramp up the ban on scrap copper and steel exports. Chair, I think on the post office, you know, we had welcomed the 2.4 billion rand relief, but it's quite worrying, Chair, we don't have a plan for the post office. It's simply allowing it to die. The headcount of the post office has plummeted from 14,000 to about just under 10,000. There's a plan to cut about 4,000 posts. And of course, the post office has been found delinquent time and again by the courts for basically fraud, for deducting pension and medical from workers, not handing it over to the funds. And then I want to cut the salaries of the post office workers who remain by 40%. You know, it's positive that in the budget we've given additional funds to Denel. We don't see a turnaround plan yet from Denel. It's quite worrying the delays in submitting the financial reports. And these are also workers who are sat for 18 months without getting paid. Chair, I think in the appropriation, there's quite a bit of positive in the appropriation, but also the MTEF, around infrastructure investments, around rail and roads and housing to student residences, sanitation and water, energy imports. We think it's a really positive. It's a significant amount of money, Chair. It's 225 billion rand this year, 900 billion of the MTEF. There's huge amounts, you know, for transport of 350 billion, for metro rail, 32 billion. I think we really want to applaud the 132 billion rand for water infrastructure because that is our next crisis. Well, not even next, it is a crisis. And the increase in funding for roads. But I think we do need to see, again, from law enforcement measures to deal with the issue of the construction mafia and extortions because it really is sabotaging quite a few projects. And I think, Chair, also they need to push local procurement more around the construction programs. Chair, we don't need to go too much into local government because it's covered under the door bill. But I think just to make the point that municipalities are in free fall, we don't really see much plans from COGTA on what are they going to do to restore local government. But at this rate, we are going to waste this local government, going to the root of our SOEs and just simply collapsing. And again, this has an impact upon companies which are forced to close. There's no water or roads or electricity. And that means we're plunging rural communities into absolute poverty and collapse. Chair, I think, you know, on the corruption front, I think we all know the issues, but we don't really see much in the probation bill that says what are we doing in the state and the different departments to tackle it. Parliament has passed, you know, positive laws like the Auditing and Mineral Act. We see few departments utilizing powers given to them. Again, Chair, I think there's a need for SARS to do lifestyle audits across the state. We see a commitment to doing it by the state, but little action. Chair, we must really raise alarm bells around the police service headcount. You know, during the World Cup, we had over 208,000 police officers. It's now plummeted to about 172,000. There was a positive appointment of 10,000 last year, a commitment for 5,000 this year. But if you compare that to an annual retirement, resignation, and death rates in the police service of about 12,000, then we're barely keeping up with the status quo. And that's not going to help with population rising, crime levels rising. And then again, we have a below CPI 3.7% increase in allocation to the police. But we do want to welcome the allocation of additional funds for the NPA and SARS to fill vacancies. And I think there is positive progress on the public procurement bill, which I think Scott had a briefing on yesterday. On the basic education chair, so we welcome allocations to the school, the sanitation, the classroom backlogs. But we really need to see a bit more accountability from the DPE of the expenditure, because time and again, they just simply kick the can down the road. And we've been having this discussion since 2004 plus. But we do want to welcome the integration of ECD into schools. And there's been positive use of the Presidential Employment Program to help appoint teaching assistants, etc. But again, this is going to come to an end when this program ends, and that's going to be a crisis. And again, sure, if we speak about growing the skills, it's quite worrying to have a below inflation increases for DBE, and that's a real term, a cut. Chair, I think we want to welcome the increase to NSFAS of 6.1%, but I think you've seen on campuses protests around the cuts to student subsidies for students, including at CPUT. I think we welcome the funding for availability for NHI, but again, we've got below inflation increases to health, so that's a cut. And we're having a real strain in the health service, with probably estimated about 97,000 vacancies that really need to be filled at some stage, both funded and unfunded. I think there's positive allocations to chair to human settlements, to informal settlements. There's positive allocations to basic services for Indigenous households, but we see increasing levels of Indigenous households not receiving the basic services, and many municipalities are simply collapsing. Chair, I think we want to welcome the infrastructure allocation to electricity. And Chair, we've been having positive programs funded under the Treasury budget line for the Neighbourhood Development Grant, for the green programs in communities, and these are positive given the levels of dumping and pollution, litter, etc. But again, this is going to come to an end at the end of this budget year, and that's going to be a crisis. Chair, I think we do just get into the end. Welcome the increased allocation for the land bank for agriculture, which is a key growth part of the economy. On the DTIC fund, we're quite worried that we have a below inflation allocation to DTIC for industrial financing export support. We decrease the funding from DBSA, yet at the same time, we expect the master plans to deliver. We do hope that additional resources will help at the mineral resources department to reduce the mining backlogs, and that's the key to growing the mining sector. So we must raise the issue of CCMA because it's having to battle the flood of workers who have lost jobs, yet we have not been keeping its budget allocations pace with that huge increase in demand. I think on the security frontier, we're worried about cuts to home affairs, the cuts in the police service headcount, the below inflation increase for the courts and correctional services, and that's really having an impact on the state's ability to deal with corruption and crime. And similarly, we're quite concerned, Chair, about the declines in the funding for the Defence Force, yet as mandated correctly so is increasing all the time. So I think, Chair, just in conclusion, the probation budget is here. I think we need to urge Parliament to hold ministers and departments accountable for the implementation to meeting the targets. We can't afford to see billions being rolled over corruption, or money being lost to corruption, etc., or commitments being abandoned. But I think we do want to raise alarm bells that if we continue to pass budgets to cut critical state services, it's going to really have a huge impact on the economy. We think there is really, on just the two fronts, a need for Parliament to reverse the budget cuts to the SOP grants, the Presidential Appointment Initiative, and to really put pressure on government to extend them beyond the end of this financial year. Chair, you know, obviously members are politicians, the elections are in 11 months, give or take. We think we need to be doing much better collectively as government, as Parliament, etc., as departments, to make sure we deliver on the budget commitments, because voters are exasperated, they're frustrated, and they'll be voting in 11 months based upon what happens in the next few months. So hopefully, Chair, I didn't exceed my time too much. I might have exceeded by 60 seconds, but thanks for members to give us the space. Thanks, Chair.
So you timed yourself in 60 seconds. I'm not sure about that. Thank you, Comrade Matthew, for the presentation. That is positive, and also being bold enough to identify issues where you don't agree. And members, as and when you deliberate on these presentations, remember what other issues were raised yesterday in the House about the wage bill. Some of the members feel that it's not necessary, but also you're raising an issue of a decreasing or cutting of politicians' packages. Is something for debate, and allow members to have a bite or engage on all the presentations. Can I hear from the members? Please raise your hand, and if you can't raise your hands, just indicate or call for my attention. A secretariat will help me. I see the hand of Honorable Okam, Honorable Ditoy, and who? Only two. Okay. Honorable Okam.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson, if you would allow me to keep my video off, I do not have very good reception.
It's fine.
Can I continue? All right.
Yes.
Chairperson, yeah, thank you very much, and thank you to all the presenters for what they presented to us today. It's good to see that we've got good public participation when it comes to the appropriation bill. I've got a few statements that are quite in general. We hear what Alta says with regard to political party funding, and we also got the worry that, unfortunately, for the ANC, they saw that their money are dripping. They could not pay salaries, and did not pay their PAYE, and maybe this is a way for them to get money for these elections. And we also think that it is exorbitant. We know that we will also benefit out of that, but it needs to be looked into so that there's a balance in what it was in the past and all of a sudden is going to be. Chairperson, when you listen at what Kusatu said, when we sit with unemployment at 42.4%, and you sit with a GDP growth of only 0.9%, you can see that this unemployment figure is not going to drop very quickly. We need to create an environment that will be conducive to investments so that we can start working on the GDP growth in our country. And until that is done, there will not be proper reducing of our unemployment figures, which will in turn have an effect on the grants that is being paid out by this country. We are in a negative snowballing effect, and as soon as we will start to do the right things, start to combat crime and combat corruption, and stop saying the wrong things that people in the rest of the world are listening to, and which deters them from investing in South Africa, we will sit with this problem of an ever-increasing unemployment figure. We need to fight corruption. We agree with Kusatu on that. We sit with this appropriation bill and we see where money is allocated towards. Unfortunately, we also saw in the past that a lot of those monies, although it were allocated, were not correctly spent. And the services for the people out there was not delivered. We need to put emphasis on the combating of corruption. And in that sense, it has been very worrying to see that our police forces numbers dwindled over the last couple of years. And we need to really enforce our police with specialist investigators that can assist in the combating of corruption, in the proper investigation of these cases. And it's therefore very worrying to see that. Chairperson, another thing that is worrying for me, in South Africa we sit with a big problem with regards to it. We heard it last week again when the figures of grade 4 pupils that can read and write for meaning, that when that came out, we sit with a basic education system that is totally underfunded. If you compare our basic education system, which is extremely important to form that first steps of reading and writing capabilities and mathematics with young children, we see that higher education budget is 3 times the amount of basic education. Now, that just simply cannot be. Unfortunately, we know that that is due to promises made by the previous president, President Zuma, when he said that basic education will be free. Now we are bearing the brunt of that, and basic education is paying for, is not getting the benefits that they should. We should look at education for our children, especially when they are young. That is when they are formed, and it's unacceptable, and I would just like to get some comments on that. With regards to the 175 out of 259 municipalities that are not managed well, it brings us to the conversation that we have every single year, and that is the one of consequence management. We talk about this, and everybody every time agrees that consequence management needs to be implemented. But we still see the same figures with our municipalities, and we still see that there aren't really any consequence management that are applied. We don't really see a lot of people that are unfit get going out of those municipalities. And that is a basic, it's a very high worrying factor if we only talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk on that. Obviously, from the DA side, we do not agree with the NHI. Any money allocated towards that, we think it's going to be a huge mistake to do that. Chairperson, we need to put emphasis on the fact that I have spoken about police, but that the Directorate of Public Prosecutions must be given enough money so that they can appoint specialist prosecutors, so that they can also incorporate people from the private sector to assist with the prosecution of some or a lot of these corruption cases. We heard what the Sonderkommission said. We see how long it takes before action in courts are really taken, and then sometimes when it gets to court, that it is not properly investigated, not properly prepared, and we need to have specialists there. And I think it's important to allocate more than what has been allocated. I think the allocation there is 75 million rand. Now, we saw that the Section 94 inquiry of the public protector, only that case's legal fees is in excess of 30 million rand already. So we need to have more money allocated towards that, because that will be a deterrent for people that want to carry on with the commitment of committing of corruption. Thank you, Chairperson. That's all from me for now.
Thank you, Honourable Okam, Honourable Fanny Ditoy.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, for the opportunity. If I'll also be allowed to keep my camera off due to light sharing and that reception.
It's fine. You can go on.
Thank you so much. Chair, I will be brief. I also want to appreciate the presentations. It's always good to get insight from the different entities, and it's really valuable. And I thank you for all the time and effort that you put into this. We definitely benefit this to, and these presentations definitely assist us to do our work better. Firstly, with the equal education, I agree with the fact that you stated that basic education is lacking and there is a shortage of funds, and I want to agree with the previous speaker, and want to stress the fact that tertiary education is getting a lot more funding than basic education, where basic education is actually there to lay the foundation for the learners of tomorrow. And that is unfortunately not happening. I mean, the recent statistics that indicated that high percentage of children cannot read and write for meaning, that is not something that will be resolved in the next year. And I think there are a lot more children that's in that same predicament, that find themselves in that same predicament. And it will take years to eradicate that. And Chair, this is not something that's only happening, has been happening this year. This is something that is historical, and we currently sitting with that challenge. We've got people that finish matric and they want to go and apply for work, but there's got a lot of challenges, and that is as a result of the failure of the education system in South Africa. And I would really support the fact that basic education's budget allocation must be higher, and the fact that those funds must be allocated to them, and it must be utilized accordingly. What's also a great concern, and very little people talk about this, Jay, is the fact that the population growth is apparently higher than the economical growth in the country. And this is something that's snowballing, and it's affecting a lot of other issues in the country as well. Everyone speaks in every debate about the social gap that's getting larger and larger. And it's as a result of the population growth that seems to be out of hand in the country. And it's something that can be discussed at a debate at a later stage. And then the EPWP and the Presidential Employment Initiatives. Yes, people are resisted to that by getting funds, but does the taxpayer really get value for money? Is there return on investment, or is this just an incentive that's dished out to people without the taxpayer actually benefiting from it? I mean, if you look at the way these appointments are actually discussed and advertised, it says that people must be employed, and it must be ensure that they make use of the most labor-intensive methods to conduct the work. I mean, dropping people off next to the road with grass cutters to slice the grass, it's not worthwhile. There's no return on investment. Why not rather do the skills transfer and ensure that these people really do what they're supposed to do? And then, yes, I think that's in a nutshell. The rest has been touched on in previous engagements. It's a fact that the budget is definitely not adequate, and the tax base is getting smaller and smaller. And we're sitting in a situation where the social part of the budget is definitely too large. I mean, people do need social support from government as a result of the high unemployment rate. But I think that's a political matter that must be addressed. And yes, the focus must be on ensuring that an environment that's conducive for economical growth is stimulated and put there instead of the way that government is currently handling things and trying to be and stay the largest employer in the country instead of allowing the public and the private sector to grow the economy and get job creation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Titoi. Honorable Mletsani, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also request not to open my video. It's a load shedding where I am now. Also take this opportunity to acknowledge the presentation. My question will go direct to the equal education. You touched the serious problem of a high percentage of the learners who cannot read who can read without understanding. Now, I just want to find out, in your view, is the Department of Education receiving enough budget and fail to spend it to support the ECD to eradicate the problem of reading without understanding? Or the department is not receiving adequate budget to be able to channel enough money to ECD to address this challenge, to empower those responsible with necessary skills? I just want to find from them, what is their recommendation in this matter in order to be given urgent attention so that it can be resolved? Because my understanding is no good foundation, no future. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, honorable members. Any other hand? There's none. Babalu, can you confirm if there's no other hand?
There's no other hand.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable members and our dear stakeholders, one, appreciate your presentation and welcome your presentation. Your views are important to this committee, and recommendations have been made in terms of this committee on what to do. But generally, what I can get from the presentations and also from the members is that the budget allocation to government departments is not enough, and I will have requested members or the stakeholders to put yourself in the shoes of the Minister of Finance or government, and looking at the situation at which we are economically in terms of our financial status. I haven't heard anybody saying, of course, what is happening or what is allocated to the department is not enough. We need more money. But where do we think this money can get? And advise a treasurer in terms of sourcing these resources that are in dire need and which we all believe they will benefit the citizens of this country. On the issue of value for money or the benefits on the EPWP and the presidential the presidential work, the intervention from the president in terms of job creation. According to some of the members or the views is that this is not benefiting the taxpayers. And I have a different view to say that those people that are working there or those people who are part of those programs are taxpayers, and they are benefiting because at the end of the day, they can put a bread on the table, they can put a plate for their kids on the table. But is that enough? What I would have appreciated as we engage as this team is to say how best can we say to those who are part of the program, do their work to their best so that we can see the outcome, because the work that they're doing, and more especially on the EPWP, the work that they're doing, is it benefiting the taxpayers? The grass cutting and all that, I think there's a reason for why the grass needs to be cut. When we talk about the patching of potholes and all those things, there's a reason why such programs are done. But at the end of the day, we should not shoot everything and say it's not necessary. People are just being dished out money. But I like the point that was raised by one of the members to say that some of the departments, they are given money and they don't spend all that money, and those monies are allocated or directed to them, or for them to be able to give quality services. Because what we need to focus on as a appropriation or as an oversight body is quality services at the end of the day, and we can only measure that by the outcome. So the outcome approach is what we need to focus on. To say, because the budget was not enough, there was no a satisfactory outcome in terms of the body that the government has put on those projects. So let's put our focus on an outcome approach view, and also assisting the government and the citizens of this country to benefit from this taxes, from this money, the pairs that we are responsible to watch or manage for their own benefit. I'm now going to allow the presenters to respond or comment or further maybe further input or clarify the issues that has been raised by members if they feel there's something that they need to add or clarify in terms of their presentation or the questions that came from the members. I will start with the equal education.
Elizabeth? Thank you, honorable members. I'm putting my camera on because at the beginning I was not able to, so you know you're not talking to a ghost. So I had one key question and perhaps one general statement or comment. And I will start with the statement or comments about higher education's budget being a whole lot bigger than the schooling sectors, while the schooling sector is primarily the foundation on which we built the skyscraper. So for us, yes, I mean, this is a fact. We cannot distract from it. But we are not also proposing a situation where we are robbing Peter to pay Paul. We believe intrinsically that education in its entirety is a vital social good, right? So basic education is very important, and so too is higher education, because the two strands of education basically serve two different purposes, or they work together to serve a bigger purpose, which is preparing citizens to be able to live productive livelihoods, either through employment or self-employment creation or being part of the labor force. So they're all good. So we are not proposing that, yes, because higher education is bigger, they must now take the money from them and give it to us. We also acknowledge that a lot of considerations went into or goes into the budgeting process in arriving at this allocation. But we still maintain that the allocation to the sector is not enough or sufficient to address the many challenges that the sector faces. And so I will use the question from the honorable member to essentially prove the point or to answer the question indirectly. So are we asking that, are we saying education is not getting enough money, therefore it cannot provide the services such as training our children to be able to read for meaning and? Or is the issue that they are getting money, but then they are not using the money properly? And so, and we are saying that it is both. It's not an either or situation, it's an and situation. So the money that goes to the education sector is not enough when we think or we calculate it using inflation into account, taking inflation into account. And so there isn't enough money to be able to buy or provide the resources and infrastructure and train teachers or pay teachers and the people who actually do the job. So that is one aspect of the equation. The other aspect is, even with this limited budget or monies that the education department gets, there is a problem with spending. They have a spending challenge. And in that, we are seeing over and over a department that has poor financial management. They're either not spending all the allocations, or they are spending money, but they're not spending it on what it is meant for or properly. And so our suggestion or recommendation this morning is that, firstly, we need to make sure that there's enough and sufficient budget for the sector to be able to work with. But beyond that, we also need to take our oversight responsibilities quite seriously in ensuring that indeed the monies are being channeled in the right places and on the right services and goods. So we are not seeing, we are not asking Treasury to basically pour money into a leaky pocket here. We are asking that, can the committee and other oversight bodies help us to sew the holes in the pocket, and so that when the money put into those pockets, it is not falling out or we are not losing those monies. So that is essentially, in a nutshell, what we are proposing here, in that we need more money, but beyond the more money as well, we need to have proper oversight and consequence management for departments misappropriating or mismanaging the funds that we are fighting for them to get, to be able to provide quality services to our school and to our learners. Thank you.
Thank you very much with that input. Before I request Public Service Accountability Monitor to come in, the issue of less budget to basic education, and when we talk about basic education, I think we include the ECD that Honorable Lezane has raised. I want us to merit it too. The more money we put, or the more money government put in basic education, it means the wage bill will increase, because it's personnel orientated. You need teachers to do the work, and those teachers need to be paid, and they need to be paid decently. Hence, I said, let's remember, you might have not been able to hear the debate yesterday in the House, where the issue of the wage bill was an issue to say money is being spent on the public servants. But then there are proposals in terms of resolving the problem that we are facing. Professionalization of the public service, making sure that there's value for money, but also there's something that one of the presenters has highlighted, and I think it's COSATU, the issue of the ghost workers. As much as we think it's not enough, have we really diagnosed why the little that we can, we can't be able to see that there's commitment, there's a value for money, and it's not enough? I'm not disputing what you're saying, but I'm just saying that you are correct. The same as the Department of Health, you need medical professionals, which is human, it's personal, and it's a need, it's not a want. And when we address that issue, or when government addresses that issue, the wage bill will go high. So maybe we also need to be serious, Comrade Matthew and the other stakeholders, to make sure that this thing of ghost workers is being attended to. And over and above all, the issue of corruption, that monies are used or are being misused, or are stolen. The money also, or the budget that is underutilized and now being redirected or returned to Treasury, that is not good for the country. So we also need to look into such behaviors and come with recommendations. I see, Mapule, you are on the platform, PBO. You're listening. We had engagements together with the FFC on some of the issues that are overlapping on this discussion. And also, Treasury, I think they are on the platform. As and when time comes for you to respond, please consider these issues that the stakeholders are raising and the members are raising. Over to you, Public Service Accountability Monitor.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I didn't note any specific comments or questions that required a response from us, but I just wanted to reiterate our appreciation the opportunity to present. I think that some of the comments made also will probably help us to strengthen our research and understanding and ability to answer some of these questions around where we can get more money for resourcing anti-corruption systems and how we can ensure value for money. So once again, thank you very much. I hope I'm covered.
Thank you very much for that comment. Outer, it's now your turn.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, for this opportunity. We do have some recommendations, and we also wish to remain respectful in making these. But some of the thoughts that we had is, for example, if you look at budgets or vote one for the presidency, we have noted that there has been an increase to the president's salary of nearly 45,000 rand. So that is from 2.9 million a year to 4.2 million. Now, as we look at public sector basic wage workers, that increases much more than what they get per annum. For the deputy president, we see there's an increase from 2.8 million to 3.5 million, which is 25%. So we do wonder whose interests then are at the forefront. Yes, we do acknowledge that the work done by the president and the deputy president is of utmost importance, but so too is ensuring that we have free and fair elections and a strengthened independent electoral commission. We are also quite concerned in terms of vote 13, which is the public works and infrastructure, particularly on the items stated as prestige accommodation and state functions that funds activities for the residents of parliamentarians, ministers, deputy president, and the president. The budget generally for this program over the past 7 years totals nearly 400 million rand. If we are working it out approximately for 400 MPs and the 90 National Council of Province meetings and the president, that is approximately 790,000 rand per person in this period. I don't know if you recently saw the article published in the press on the 21st of May. It was published by News24 City Press. The title of this article is The Taxpayers Pay 93 million rand to upgrade ministers' kitchens, to install generators and to kill cockroaches. Now, the concerns raised within this article is the type of funds that are being utilized for public servants, once again, MPs, ministers, etc., where 1.4 million rand is being utilized to upgrade a kitchen. One of the items is 240,000 rand for cockroaches. We are concerned in terms of these expenditure being confirmed by the Public Works and Infrastructure Minister that indicates that these are the amounts being allocated. So we can also see some elements of tender corruption raising big question marks on these items. An example that is given then is the fumigation of cockroaches, 240,000 rand. There are three different invoices for those, nearly 80,000 rand to do so. There's a fallen curtain rail that was charged at 54,000 rand. And then the exchange of light bulbs in another property in Waterkloof for approximately 19,000 rand. And there's audacious amounts also being allocated regarding swimming pools. For example, recently, an upgrade for a kitchen in a minister's house cost 1.4 million rand. I know this does go off a bit in terms of public reporting in the media, but we have to question that if there's approximately 1 billion rand going into various ministerial benefits, whether this does not come at the cost of our democracy and the IEC. So perhaps those are the type of figures that can be reconsidered when looking at the budget appropriation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fisher. I hear what you say in terms of the increment of the president and the deputy president. I wish you would go down to the parliamentarians. And the picture out there that is being painted, that the parliamentarians are getting a lot of money. And I'm saying this because Kosati has mentioned this in terms of the reduction of the packages. I don't know, because I wish some of bother themselves to come and understand as to how much do you take home and how much do you spend, how much work do you do compared to what you earn. It's very important because I for one, I think the public is to a certain extent they're being misinformed about what the politicians or the parliamentarians are being compensated for. Together with the public servants, you know, you go to social media, you go to, you know, other media houses, you hear what people are saying, what the media is saying about the kind of the situation that we find ourselves. They will always make an example of police, that we have this high level of crime because police are being underpaid. I'm not sure if we are sure about the facts, and I'm talking from an experience as a former public servant and a former unionist. We know at all times that there will be a fight for one or for those members or public servant to get their increment, which is not necessarily enough. But with the commitment of the minister, Minister Kiewit, yesterday in the House, she did indicate that they have started with the lifestyle audit of the public servants, because they want to deal with this issue of corruption also, because the lifestyle that some of the colleagues are living, it's beyond what they are getting. But I'm just concerned that the parliamentarians are not compensated as it is painted outside. It's not as glossy and good as it is portrayed. I don't know if other members think what they are getting is more. Maybe it's only a few of us. Kosat Dukrek Matthew, you can come in.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, thanks to members for the questions. So I think just to want to appreciate that, I think most issues were all speaking from the same hymn book. Chair, look, on the issue of political party funding, look, we've had a lot of debate on it. You know, we think there are pros and cons to it, especially given the fiscal crisis that we're all facing. But we think, Chair, there is an argument to be made to increase political party funding for political parties. And I think our point of view, Chair, is that look, political parties, they govern the state. And you have criminal elements, business people, tender entrepreneurs, etc., who would want to take advantage of political parties. And nowadays, it's not just, you know, the ANC, the DA, who are political parties ruling the state in different levels, but in fact, it's across the party spectrum. Almost all parties are nowadays part of the governing at some level of the state. So we think that there's a motivation to be made for to increasing it, especially during an election year, which is quite expensive. To help protect and insulate parties from being vulnerable or exposed to corruption. If we can protect the political landscape, so to speak, that benefits society if we're helping to reduce corruption, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, Chair, for us, it was critical that you can motivate for increased funding for political parties through the IEC, et cetera. But then political parties need to disclose funding to the IEC. We should not be receiving reports of this and that party running away from disclosing. We know there are teething problems, but we think we should be moving to a scenario where we increase public funding. In exchange, all funding is disclosed and disclosed timelessly, made transparent, etc. That's how we think we're going to help, you know, reduce corruption, and that'll benefit all parties. Chair, I think Honourable Ocampo is 100% right. The solution to all of our issues across the fiscus, etc., is to grow the economy. So we have to do the fundamental obstacles, which is the load shedding, the decimation of Transnet, metro rail, the backlogs in the ports, the backlogs in mining rights applications, the issues of crime and corruption, etc. But also, Chair, it's about helping young people to get into the labor market, to get experience and skills and confidence. And Honorable Okumba is right, also to avoid political clumsiness we see across political parties at times, which just doesn't help anybody. And of course, it's about the efficiency of expenditure. You'll find, for example, Chair, in the police service, about two-thirds of the police service are deployed to head office, provincial office, or desk jobs, when we should be shifting them to community policing, to specialized units. We find that about two-thirds of police vehicles are never in working condition. And of course, we have a huge problem of court backlogs. So police officers, detectives say, is it worthwhile pursuing this case if it's just going to be stuck and you have 12 appearances in court? And many complaints just simply give up. I think Okumba and Molitani are correct about basic education. It's quite alarming. You have huge levels of dropouts from the number of children into grade R, grade 1, to the number of matriculants. About half would drop out at some stage. Half the kids would get a matric exemption, etc. That's quite worrying. And the never-ending story of backlogs on sanitation, on classes, the whole infrastructure, textbooks. How do we expect teachers to teach quality education if they're teaching 60 kids in a classroom where the learner-teacher ratio is rising because of freezing posts in the public service, etc.? Doesn't make sense. Many teachers and kids in the Cape Flats fear for their lives, even in primary schools, Chair, because gangs are just able to come into school property at any time. We do need a proper discussion, Chair, about the role of CETAs and TVET colleges, because not everybody can go or should go to university. But here is a role to off-ramp people when they matriculate to get artisan skills and so forth. And I think, Chair, the really is we need to have a hard discussion on what we spend in our CETA. Does it make sense to the economy? Many of those courses there, to be honest, are nothing less than corruption opportunities. And yet business will say we have a shortage of this skill or that skill. The funding is available in the CETA. The appetite is there amongst young people, but we're not getting the right management in place to deliver. And Chair, again, Okumba is right around consequence management at local government level. We're seeing a very sad and painful rate of many municipalities returning huge billions of dollars infrastructure funding to national government, because once you started to crack down on corruption, they struggled to know how to spend money on infrastructure. Yet we all know in places like Matabeleland, or in fact across the Northwest and many other municipalities, infrastructure is collapsing, roads are just falling apart at alarming rates, yet money has been returned to treasury because municipal managers, councillors are not competent, not fit to serve. So you're right, we need to have a consequence management. We do need a new funding model, because some of the municipalities are also not sustainable financially. The rates base is just too small. If you look at some of them, like Lichtenberg, Frankfurt, Lanesburg, etc., we do need to consolidate some of them before they collapse, before it's too late. Chair, just in terms of the presidential employment programs, look, we think it's well worth it. The funding last year was about $24 billion. We were getting 1 million people on it, so it's quite a big bang for your buck. It's helped a lot of people get into the labor market. There's been very positive feedback from those who hosted them at schools, etc., from principals who said it really had a positive impact upon schools, upon quality of teaching, because these were now teaching assistants, etc. There's been many positive reports of the skills they've learned and so forth, and positive reports about them finding employment afterwards, which is the ultimate objective. We think there's a space, Chair, to expand the presidential program beyond this year, expand across the state to the police service, to customs, to home affairs, etc., where there's a huge crisis around service delivery capacity and so forth. Chair, we do agree, though, around public works and community works programs. Often these have become a source of cheap labour. Often with very little skills and so forth, we should be rejigging them. And there is discussion taking place with DPW around kind of positioning to support SMEs, to support the growth of new economic sectors like recycling, for example, or more environmental management. We think there is a need to tap into partner with the CETAs around it, and perhaps to consolidate some of them, and also to see how can they be linked to artisan programs in the private sector, where you can have a real positive roadmap to getting people into employment. Chair, I think you raised correctly the issue that we want so many things from the fiscus. Where does the money come from? Because you can't print it. Which I think for us, the simplest, most effective, quick way to do that is to invest in SARS. I mean, SARS has shown you with an additional 500 staff, investment in IT capacity, a competent management, they have generated an additional 94 billion rand in tax revenue collections. Chair, we think if you give them more, there's much more space. I think we've got a tax compliance rate of about 64% compared to an average in Europe, and we know it's not a great example to compare to, of 90%. So there is space to do it. And again, if you crack down on customs, you help protect local manufacturing companies and jobs, you protect state investments in the economy. We think there is, as you're saying, Chair, around livestock audits of the wealthy, not just in the state, but in the private sector too, because you can see many people are taking advantage of loopholes. Chair, we just have been raising the issue of physical headcount because I think we all know the example of PRASA, with about 3,000 ghost posts in a relatively small, not too small, but medium-sized company. We think there's many other indicators in municipalities and departments and entities of ghost posts. And that's not a complicated thing to do. It's a physical headcount. You can do it in 3 months, 6 months. But we think you'll find significant savings there. Chair, I think for us on the issue of public office bearers, so I think the point is not to pick on members of parliament. You know, members of parliament don't make a huge amount of money. But if you look at what members of cabinet make, deputy ministers, MECs, premiers, what members of the management committees or some of our entities like the Road Management Traffic Corporation, the Paris Service, etc., they make a huge amount of money. It can't be correct here that the executive managers at the RTMC make what the president makes. Doesn't make sense. Chair, I think also for us is that many of these members of cabinet, for example, MECs, essentially live for free. They live in state housing, state cars, electricity, generators, water, a lot of perks that we constantly see. We know for MPs it's not the case, they say they live in parliamentary villages, which is nothing really to write home about. But I think, Chair, that's the one thing. But I think, Chair, also we're telling public servants that the state doesn't have money to give inflation increases to nurses, to police officers who barely make 15,000 rand a month, to cleaners who don't even earn enough to pay income tax, yet a minister who might make 20, 30 times what they make. We think there needs to be a discussion on how do we reduce the wage gap. Also, how do we send a symbolic message to cleaners and security guards, to teachers, police officers, that government is going to share their pain. But I don't think, Chair, we should be saying that, ministers are struggling, and a police officer who risks his life every day, or a correctional service officer who is dealing with criminals, doesn't deserve to have more sympathy shifted towards them. But I think we do, you're right, we need a proper discussion, because often it is a quick thing to simply say public service wage bill is the problem, but we don't look at what are the granular details of a police officer who earns 180,000 a year, can't afford a house, is living in a backyard, takes metro rail to work, is exposed to real criminality targeting him because of his firearm, etc. But I think, Chair, we do need to move to a more equal society, and perhaps we should also include the private sector in the discussion, because as much as the wage gap in the public sector is bad at about 13 to 1 on average, in the private sector it's 3 times that, where you have a banking clerk earning 80,000 in a year, and the CEO of the bank earning 150,000 in a single day, similarly in the retail, mining sectors, etc. But I think I'm diverging, Chair, that's really outside the appropriation bill. But I think the point is, if we have limited resources in the state, we should be shifting it towards the frontline workers who are really struggling to survive, or seeing where can we have a more solidarity-based approach on the fiscus. But yeah, sorry for talking too long, Chair, apologies for that.
No problem, Comrade Matthew. I think you are talking to issues that are very important to the public out there. I think members are also interested in this debate that we are having, the discussions, because these are very important issues, and it's us as the oversight body, together with our partners here, who must talk about it, clarify them, give a way forward in terms of dealing with them. So I really want to start by appreciating your time, the inputs that you have made. They have not fallen on deaf ears. We have heard them. And as Comrade Matthew is saying, we need to have discussions around these issues. The issue of ghost workers is good that at least there's somewhere where they've been found, but also on public service. In my previous life, I've seen that. But also what was raised by, public service accountability, or is it outer, about the fumigation and all those things. I think those things are wrong. If for fumigation of cockroaches, we are not saying people should live with cockroaches, because the health system also will be burdened. The families, there's the social life of their families will be affected. It's not a good thing. They need to be attended to. But what we need to look at, to look in, is a matter of how much do we spend for us to do this. Get the reasonable company that will do good work. I'm not promoting corruption, and I'm not promoting the misuse of public funds. It's not acceptable at all. But we really need the discussions around these issues here. And it does not help to come here on the platform, be on the YouTube, be on all social media, on TV, and just talk about them for the sake of talking. I think when we deal with the report, the engagements after engaging with the Treasury, getting responses, our report will have to be strong on recommendations. And unfortunately, we are coming to the end of our term. The next committee in the 7th administration will have to deal with it. Also on the issue of the party funding on the IEC, it is something that needs to be spoken about. And I hear the voices that are too far, are very faint. It's not as strong as I thought it will be, because the amount that is allocated for party funding overall is 300 million. And just imagine how many political parties do we have. So what do we think needs to be done to deal with this? And also the issue of the IEC that has been raised by other members. So these are the issues that we need to be very strong on them and make follow-ups, track our resolutions from the House as we present our reports. I want to appreciate the opportunity for being with you, and we are now going to item number 5. Other stakeholders, you can be excused and attend to your other commitment. If so, we now are left, will be left with COSATU and Dear South Africa on the ESCOM debt relief bill, the B55, number B55 of 2023. With that, honorable members, let's allow COSATU, Comrade Matthew, to make a presentation.
Thanks, Chair, and apologies for holding members hostage and for talking too many issues. We'll just put up the presentation quickly, Chair. So, thanks, Chair, just to for giving us space, Kosata, just to share our view on the ESCOM debt relief bill. We thought really this is a critical intervention by government. And as Kosata, we really welcome it. We support its passage by Parliament. We've long championed this, Kosata, since 2019 for the fiscus to take over ESCOM's unsustainable debt levels. As part of a package which enables ESCOM to stabilize, to rebuild, and to play the role it must play in the economy. Whilst we support the bill, overall, Chair, we are concerned about some of the ESCOM debt relief conditions, in particular barring ESCOM from investing in new generation capacity. Chair, I think the bill does correctly highlight the need for measures to tackle the ever-rising levels of debt owed to ESCOM by many municipalities, but we don't really there doesn't really appear to be a concrete program action to address this threat to ESCOM survival. There's been many words from Treasury, from other parties in government over the years, but we don't see real practical actions or plans. The bill and the conditions are also premised, Chair, upon the 18.65% tariff hike this year and the 12.71% tariff hike next year. But yet they're silent on the continuous double-digit tariff hikes we've had since load shedding started in 2006 and the effect these have had on the economy, on workers, on businesses, etc. Chair, our support for the ESCOM debt relief bill overall is premised that ESCOM is too important. It's our most critical national economic asset. We can't afford for it to fail. I think we all see the pain right now. It generates 95%, it transmits and distributes 100% of our electricity. And the entire economy, all our jobs, workers' ability and stability depends upon a modern and functioning ESCOM. And I think it's also critical that as we deal with ESCOM debt, that we look at what are the causes of it. And that's the rampant theft and corruption, which we know, in particular, Madupi and Kusile, institutional mismanagement, neglect, a lack of investment in aging infrastructure, and of course, also the rising levels of debts owed to ESCOM by consumers. Chair, we proposed in October 2019 at Parliament, at the Alliance, at NEDLAC, that government needs to take over half of ESCOM's debt. We then signed a NEDLAC ESCOM social compact with government in 2020 and social partners. So we're quite pleased and we really want to applaud government for heeding this call and taking over, quite a bold two-thirds of 254 billion rand of ESCOM's debt. And we really must applaud government for doing that. It was not an easy choice, we appreciate. We think, Chair, this is really going to help enable ESCOM to shift its limited resources to focus on ramping up maintenance. This is the fastest way to ending load shedding. And of course, that's easing the burden on workers, the economy, the families, the fiscus, companies, and so forth. But we are worried about some of the debt conditionality attached to the debt relief. Number one is the issue of prohibiting ESCOM for the time being whilst to receive debt relief from investing new energy generation capacity. We don't think this makes sense. One of the key causes of load shedding is ESCOM's generation fleet is simply nearing the end of its lifespan in many areas. It's going to take time for new generation capacity to come on board. And yes, whilst ESCOM's immediate focus must be to fix and to maintain existing capacity, if we want to, in the long term, ensure ESCOM's sustainability, and also to prevent load shedding from becoming a permanent fixture, then we need to also not only to invest in fix the existing capacity, but begin to invest in new capacity. So we think this condition will perversely ensure ESCOM in the long term continues to spend money on aging expensive infrastructure when it needs to begin building a modern and efficient and less costly generation capacity for it to survive and to protect the nation from permanent load shedding. We're also worried about the attempt and the conditions to undermine collective bargaining by some of the wage conditions attached in the bill. Doesn't mean that there should be a blank check, but we think, Chair, we need to respect collective bargaining. Chair, our proposals on the debt on these issues are simply that the prohibition on ESCOM investing new generation capacity should be removed from the ESCOM debt relief package. ESCOM should be allowed, where prudent, to do so, whilst doing the issue of maintenance. And the clause seeking to preempt and undermine collective bargaining process at ESCOM, we think, should also be removed as well. Chair, on the municipal debt, the bill is correctly highlighting the need to tackle growing levels of money owed to ESCOM. That's past 57 billion rand is continuing to rise. ESCOM loses on average about 20 billion rand a year. Much of this is from about 41 of the nation's most financially distressed municipalities. So the bill calls for measures to address this, including moving towards a single prepaid electricity regime, yet it doesn't provide a clear plan for this. And we don't see much coming from DMRE, DPE, COGTA, SALGO, ESCOM. Tackling the debt share, the money we owe to ESCOM really is key if it's going to be able to recover and to invest in maintenance of a new generation and to end load shedding. So this really has to be a perspective of recovery plan for ESCOM. Our proposal, which we've been raising for some time, including ESCOM Social Compact, is for all customers to move towards prepaid electricity, not just half prepaid and half or pay when you feel like it. This is going to ultimately reduce the levels of debt owed to ESCOM and ensure it's got the necessary daily cash flow to be operational and liquid. Government needs to look at what debt is recoverable, which is recoverable needs to pursue it aggressively and give support to ESCOM where it does so. We do definitely need to share a new funding model for municipalities because many of them are simply collapsing. And if you look at which ones are owing ESCOM money, it's those which are just basically falling apart, especially in the Free State and Northwest. So they're taking money that is owed to ESCOM and using it to plug other holes. And we need to have a proper discussion what's the appropriate way to sustain these municipalities who don't really have much of a rates base. We need to see much more aggressive support being given to ESCOM by law enforcement, especially on the issue of illegal electricity connections. At the same time, Chair, we've seen many municipalities quietly walking away from their obligation to provide indigenous households free electricity. They made it very difficult for these households to register. Most households don't know you need to register once a year in some municipalities. So we think, Chair, there needs to be a holding of SALGO and COGTA accountable, make sure all indigenous households are registered, do receive the free electricity. And of course, we're going to look at increasing its allocation as we deal with the issue of debts being owed to ESCOM. So the bill says the Treasury believes it necessary for ESCOM to receive the 18% this year and 12% hike next year. And yes, this might appease ESCOM, but it's a further blow to workers and the economy and to businesses. I'm just going to encourage those who can afford to do so to go off grid, which is going to further shrink ESCOM's customer base. And that's going to put further pressure on it to raise tariffs even again and again. Since 2006, Chair, ESCOM has been having these double-digit tariff hikes. And every year, they've been selling it that this is a short-term pain for 1 or 3 years. And so then, ESCOM has got cost-reflective tariffs, and this will end load shedding. Instead, Chair, we witnessed the opposite. We're seeing unprecedented levels of rising levels of load shedding. Chair, I think also the argument of ESCOM about a cost-reflective tariff regime is a bit disingenuous. They're deflecting from their failure to manage themselves properly within the PFMA. They're failing to tackle issues of corruption, wasteful expenditure. Madupi and Kusile were meant to cost 100 billion rand. We've long passed 200 billion rand, and they're still struggling to provide electricity. And as they're being repaired, they're finding more and more shoddy parts were supplied by the contractors, and hence need to be repaired at huge cost. So cost-reflective tariff regime, yes, theoretically it's right, it must be done, but it needs to be based upon an ESCOM which is not a poster boy for corruption and malfeasance. So a proposal here simply chairs for Treasury to work much more closely with ESCOM supply chain management to identify all the financial leakages, to develop a plan to end them, and to report to the Parliament quarterly on the progress made. ESCOM really does need to have its hand held. We think, Chair, there's additional need for support to ESCOM if this bill is to succeed. This includes the role of the law enforcement giving support to ESCOM. ESCOM can't arrest anybody. We need to see the police, the SIU, the Hawks, state security, all playing their role. We need to look at how to bring about new generation capacity, ending the regulatory blockages. So proposal, Chair, basically, let's escalate the enforcement of the scrap metals export ban and look at how we can regulate the informal traders who are thriving off cable theft. The deployment of specialized support from law enforcement to ESCOM, to prioritize cases affecting ESCOM in the court and by the NPPA, and to also utilize a legal framework like the Criminal Matters Amendment Act, which was passed, I think, 2015, which really enables government to use heavy sanctions for those involved in cable theft, as well as the Auditing Amendment Act. I think, Chair, just to get to the conclusion, so we do welcome the positive parts of the ESCOM debt bill. We believe it's going to provide the support ESCOM needs to ramp up maintenance and to end load shedding. But we are concerned about some of the conditions, in particular the prohibition on ESCOM investing in new generation capacity, which we feel is tying its hands behind its back. We agree with the bill highlighting the need to tackle municipal debt, but we need a clear plan to deal with this. We can't afford to just issue statements, as the previous finance minister will do, and then to have no follow-up action. And I think, Chair, we really need to see Treasury, the Chief Procurement Office, working very closely with ESCOM to deal with this fiscal leakages and develop an accurate, cost-effective regime that doesn't subsidize or budget for corruption, for wasteful expenditures, and they expect the public to bail them out. And of course, law enforcement needs to play the role of supporting ESCOM if we're to ensure it's viable. So I think, yeah, that's our presentation in a nutshell, Chair. Hope we stuck to it. It's a positive bill, but we are worried about some of the conditions. But overall, we do want to appreciate and to welcome the package. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you, Kosatu. And I now hand over to Dear South Africa.
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. It's Rob Atchison here from Dear South Africa, Dr. Cyril Zile. And if I may just share my screen and get on with the presentation. Sorry, Chair. Okay. You can see it. All right. Just a quick summary of what Dear South Africa Dossier Zile is. It's a public participation platform that is non-partisan. We don't support any, we don't have any political interference from anyone or from any group. We are, it operates as a non-profit platform. It facilitates public participation by informing reporting, collating data, collecting comments from the public, and providing summaries to government and various parliamentary committees. We also assist other non-profits and NGOs to conduct proper public participation within their campaign. We've done quite a number of campaigns over the past 5 years and delivered an incredible amount of comments through to various parliamentary committees and individuals. We have a subscriber base of active participants of 1.2 million wide, and it is nationwide, down to provincial, municipal, and even down to suburb level, even through different demographics and employment status. Through the ESCOM Debt Relief Bill, we hosted a campaign on the mobile platform, and which allowed participants to find out more about the ESCOM Debt Relief Bill. We provided the documents, the bill itself, a summary, and a live view of comments by other individuals so that participants could get an idea of what was said. The bill was presented in a non-partisan way. It's not a petition, I must reiterate that. We held no views, we allowed the public to have their say. Each entry was individually delivered to the Secretary Committee, and this report is based on 9,298 comments that were received by the closing date. They are supplied and available on the participation page, which is on the dearsouthafrica.co.za platform. We going into the data, most of the comments did originate from Gauteng due to population density, as they tend to do, followed by the Western Cape and then KZN. I've also provided the details on employment status of those who did participate, and retired employed. Did see the greatest participation from there. The first question that was asked on the platform was a simple question. Do you support the 2023 ESCOM debt relief bill as proposed by government? And we did provide the report in itself, so the public could go through it as it is. A resounding no, 95.61%, 8,799 people said no, while 3.14% said not fully, which means they either did or don't based on conditions, and then 1.25% said yes, they definitely do. And I'll go into detail as to why and when the reasons for that. Broken down by employment status, for the no, I do not category, the employed and retired, we had the highest say in those, and the yes, I do, again, it was employed and retired, and not fully, once again, employed and retired. That's linked to the overall participation there. A selection by province, you can see which provinces said mostly no, and yes, or not fully. And again, I won't go into too much detail as this is available for you to go through in your own time. The second question that was proposed was based on the chapters in the bill, or the clauses in the bill, and was provided an option for participants to provide their own open comments under the other section, and also no concern for ease of use. As you can see, most participants went beyond the bill, or the chapters in the bill, and to provide other reasons why and suggestions as to why. In fact, a huge majority did there. And the second one was the direct charges for requirements of ESCOM as per the chapter in the bill. If we go further into top reason by status, it's interesting to note, again, you can go through this in your own time for sake of time constraints. You can go further and you can see which sector, employment sector, had concerns around which clause in the bill, if it was other. And you can go through by all sections there. However, it's a lot of data to go through, and it's high-level data that doesn't really present the true nature of it, and it can often be misleading. So we did a comment-by-comment analysis and presented it as a word cloud. What we do here is to take all 9,500 comments and put them into a bit of software, and then we draw common words which pop up throughout every single comment. And unfiltered, we limit it to each word must appear at least 450 times. And if it's unfiltered, it comes out as ESCOM, corruption, money, debt, government, and so on. Those being the most frequent words used. And this is interesting to understand the views of the public and the major concerns, and eventually to how the bill can be restructured to be more appealing to the public across all sectors. We filter it, we filter common words such as ESCOM, pay, or more, ANC, just, and the rest on the left-hand side of that. And we can see the most greatest concerns, the words most frequently used by the 9,500 participants, is money, corruption, and government. And the comments will reflect reasons why those words come up quite a bit. The words that do come up are concerns around debt, accountability, taxpayer costs to taxpayer, theft, and electricity. And municipalities also does come up there. Another one to take note of is private and privatization. They do come up as suggestions quite frequently. The top words that we use, as I mentioned, money is a major concern for the participants across all sectors, followed by corruption and government, and then debt. In response to question one, which was, do you support this bill? The second question The categories often there offered there were yes, I do support it, no, I do not, and not fully. Of the yes, I do comments, as I've written there, participants were mostly concerned over a failing national electricity provider and what could happen to the South African economy should it fail. The concerns around load shedding are clear, and there seems to be a concern around no end to load shedding. And also, interesting enough, a concern around renewables, which don't seem to be able to provide the consistent power needed for base load. Further comments were also raised over concerns around much needed maintenance to eliminate the breakdowns, which seem to be occurring more and more frequently. Of the not fully comments, most of the participants are in favour of the debt relief bill for reasons that will become clear. And however, they have conditions attached to them, as I didn't mention, and most are surrounding the elimination of corruption, the mismanagement, the ongoing mismanagement, recovery of stolen funds, a lack of transparency and accountability, and a change in the non-payment culture of municipalities and individual users. And then in the no, I do not support the bill, the largest category there, participants were raised concern mostly over the same conditions attached to the not fully, however, without providing solutions or so on. Again, there was corruption, mismanagement, the constant bailouts that Eskom has incurred or has received over the past few years, a lack of convictions of those already found guilty, and political interference in the operations of Eskom. They do provide solutions, including a strong call for privatization, reduction of employees, and the employment or re-employment of skilled individuals, and of course the recovery of municipal debt. I provided a few comments, just cherry picked from the full comment list for each section. Again, you can see the full comments in the PDF that is available on the platform. I do think it is also distributed to the committee. If not, the committee secretary can just contact me and I will provide it to all members. What I've done here is just pull comments from individuals across the board according to employment status and try to represent the full comments in here. Comment from Poppy, who is unemployed. She says she fully and strongly supports Eskom, this Eskom bill, and makes a note that if Eskom doesn't get financial aid, the problems surrounding South Africa would continue to be there. She makes a note that she is employed, has many, and speaks for many who are unemployed, and she's also disabled and lives alone. She cannot afford anything unless they receive handouts, and that she's not responsible for the full down issues driven down further by the circumstances of mismanagement. Nolandi says additionally there must be a monitoring of the use of funds as well as the awarding of tenders to prevent any irregularities that might surround this Eskom debt relief bill. The delegations of authorizations, one of the chapters of the bill. Pinky, who's a business owner, states that funding Eskom is crucial and so there was left of our economy, and the country does depend on Eskom and the provision of electricity. She points out that energy crisis does take away jobs as many companies are closing down due to constant load shedding, and does say that the Eskom debt relief bill is in favour of all citizens and definitely is needed. Again, of the, yes, I do support it. Mark is an employed individual, provides quite a comprehensive comment here. And again, I must reflect that this is a presentation of the comments provided by the public, not by Diaspora of Africa, just the website itself, although I will provide a summary at the end there. He supports the bill with conditions, as most people do, and focuses on restructuring ESCOM, set clear goals as to how ESCOM will tackle corruption, and that ESCOM and individuals, ESCOM allows individuals to pay directly through to ESCOM, more so, and makes a serious comment about municipalities and unclean audits. He does provide a solution in how ESCOM can manage their debt owed by municipalities, and I think it is quite a good comment, which does sum up what is the problem with ESCOM and debt collection from municipalities. Christopher is also a business owner. Again, thought this was perhaps a petition to convince people to not to oppose this bill. Again, it's not, but he does provide an excellent solution and excellent comments where he says ESCOM is losing confidence of the markets and the ability to raise outside debt if they do it at a higher rate. And he does raise a good point that we need to look at reality. If ESCOM fails, there will be a dire consequences for the country, and suggests that we do raise tariffs and recover money directly through that. Another suggestion from not fully from the Kerbis, ESCOM can only receive loans from taxpayers if the company is privatized, as the government should not be in business. This reiterates a call by many people in this category on privatization of ESCOM. There is a strong call for privatization of coal, which to just interject right now, to reinvest in coal-fired power stations. However, there are certain issues that will place restrictions on that. Delegation of authorizations, the mess created as a result of gross mismanagement and blatant corruption has brought ESCOM to its knees. This is, again, a feeling that has been brought forward by many participants, and this is brought by Len, who's employed. Diane suggests that ESCOM, that we lower ESCOM's proposed direct charges against the National Revenue Fund by 50% and increase electricity tariffs by 25%. Quite a bold move there. However, I can see the reasoning behind it, which is explained in her comment. She also focuses on those who can install rooftop solar, and perhaps we should mention the incentives recently granted on that, which have gone a long way to do that. We should be looking at more incentives proposed by SARS to encourage rooftop solar and getting people off the grid. And Naomi, who's a business owner, sums up the reasons here and why no out or not category. And she makes one point that there is no clear plan on the future use of coal, and the continued use of coal will have an impact on South Africa's exports to the European Union in the coming years. So we could see South Africa is a great producer of coal, yet we are exporting a lot of it and of the good quality coal, and we should be focusing on reusing that here. However, that will affect our carbon footprint and international carbon emissions regulations or goals. And the talk about silence is deafening on nuclear power stations. Should we be investing more in nuclear power stations, or should we? What is the plan around that? Sorry, Chair, I'll just go through the rest here, as I do see I'm running out of time. But again, I encourage the committee and members please to go through these comments in full, which are available and for download or by request on the dsf.co.za, the website and platform at that address there. In conclusion, Chair, there is an overwhelming objection to the Eskom debt relief bill. However, there's a clear understanding that the lights do need to be kept on and that the South African economy will not survive if Eskom does fail. As a comrade from Kastati did mention there, Eskom is perhaps too large to fail at this stage. There are major concerns with mismanagement, accountability, transparency, and corruption. And Chair, will throwing money at Eskom solve the problems that we have in electricity generation and around load shedding when mismanagement, transparency, and corruption still remain? There are good suggestions on privatization, meaningful independent oversight of this bill and the allocations, and skilled employees and management need to be resort, and Eskom's operations need to be free from political interference. One point to note is that throughout these comments, it is clear that public trust and confidence in Eskom's ability and also in government oversight has clearly eroded. Government and Eskom have some work to do, perhaps in public relations there, to show positive results. We have not seen enough success stories in Eskom, whether it has been in management corruption or in resuscitating or managing breakdowns. The negative impact of the climate goal agreements held at the presidency level will impact private investment in coal-fired power stations, as government has clearly stated that there's going to be a move away from coal, which is a major concern if you're looking to see investment in private investment in coal-fired power stations. There simply will be none while climate goals do exist. And we need immediate and affordable solutions to our energy crisis in South Africa. There has recently been a signed deal and agreement with Coal Powership. However, the 20-year agreement has caused some public outrage, and perhaps this does need to be re-looked. Chair, that's it from me. I thank you for the opportunity to present the voice of the public.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Dear South Africa, I will now request the members to deliberate or engage on the presentation by show of hands, those who will want to have a bite on the discussion, and those who cannot, secretariat will assist me or just call for my attention. I see Honorable Otham, Moletsane. We have only these two, Dumabalo?
That's correct, Chairperson.
Okay. Honorable Otham, you can kickstart.
Thank you, Chairperson. If you will still allow me to have my video off due to connectivity problems. Chairperson, yeah, okay. I want to thank both the presenters for their presentations. I want to start with Dear South Africa. It really was a very interesting presentation that you gave to us. And yeah, I would like to really thoroughly work through that. We fully agree from the DA side that privatization is, at the end of the day, the only thing that will work. Our opinion is that we will, as long as Eskom remains as it is, we will keep on doing these bailouts. We will keep on paying money over or writing money off or taking debt over from them. As long as they are in the situation that they are with regards to the corruption that are not really tackled within Eskom and with regards to the dividing of ESCOM into the three entities. That brings me, and this is a question to both the presenters, to what they think the conditions should be for this ESCOM debt relief bill. We talk about what conditions might be. We have asked the Minister of Energy, we've asked the Minister of Finance, what conditions are they going to attach to this? If you look at some of the comments of, I think it was Mark in this presentation of Dear South Africa, it's clear that people want to see what are the attachments or the requirements for ESCOM to adhere to in order to be able to get this money. And we are still not clear on exactly what that would be. Thank you very much for the presentation there, Dear South Africa. The chairperson, with regards to COSATU, ESCOM is too big to fail. We all agree on it. But yet it did. ESCOM failed. ESCOM is failing us. As I'm sitting here, I have got load shedding and I'm battling to have a proper signal on the school. South Africans are battling because ESCOM failed. ESCOM is clearly not fulfilling its mandate to supply power to the people of South Africa because we've got 8 to 10 hours of load shedding every day, if not more. Chairperson, COSATU, you say that your first concern is the prohibition of ESCOM's investing in new generation capacity. What do you see as the real generation options that should be looked into? We agree on the fact that ESCOM must be concentrating on fixing existing infrastructure. The problem is that over the years, maintenance was not done. Proper maintenance on the existing infrastructure wasn't done. Power stations were designed wrongly, were built, and as you rightly said there, we've got 100 billion rands that was planned for Kusile, and then we are sitting at 200 million, billion, and still it's not fully in operation. Stuff like that should not happen. Then a very important thing that I want to ask maybe both presenters, we see that a lot of people in the comments on Dear South Africa said that the money that comes in for electricity bills must go to ESCOM. We have long asked for a ring fencing of money that consumers pay with regards to the electricity bills. We know that money comes into a municipality, and unfortunately the municipalities, as we saw in the previous question session that we had, or public presentation session that we had, most municipalities are run very poorly. Municipalities get in the money that consumers pay for ESCOM, but they then use it for salaries or other administrative functions that they've got. I think it is very important that we look at ring fencing money for electricity so that it goes to ESCOM, so that ESCOM does not sit with this big problem of municipalities not paying them. So I would like to get your comments on that. Chairperson, just on ESCOM's other proposal, the Treasury must work with ESCOM to identify all financial leakages, develop a plan to end them, and to report to the nation quarterly on progress made in this regard. We fully agree. But one thing is for certain, and that is that leakages won't be stopped as long as ESCOM is not dealing with the endemic corruption within ESCOM. We need to root it out. I don't want to now talk about Mr. De Reiter and his comments. That square is investigating that, and I think there would be a lot of investigations with regards to that. The fact of the matter is that we saw it in the Zonda Commission, what transpired in the Zonda Commission. We know that ESCOM is rife with endemic corruption. And as long as that is not addressed, and as long as we don't see proper prosecution of people that is involved with that, and proper investigation into those matters, leakages will occur all over the place. Then, with regards to your statement, COSATU, that the escalating enforcement of the scrap metals export ban and measures to regulate the informal traders, I want to make the statement, and I did it the other day in the House as well, Chief, as you remember, that it is not scrap metal dealers, legal scrap metal dealers, that are the reason for the collapse of ESCOM. It is the endemic corruption within ESCOM. I think we are closing a huge market for people in South Africa, and I'm talking about, we should enforce the legality of those licenses. We must make sure that people that do trade in scrap metal does it legally and does not accept scrap metal that was obtained illegally. But to extend the ban, it's again having a huge effect on employment in our country. It's got a huge effect on electricity, on income, revenue for those companies. They are battling as it is. And I think that an extension of the scrap metal ban will be very disastrous on legal scrap metal dealers. We need to police it. We can't just stop it. If we must stop everything that we cannot police, nobody will be able to do anything in South Africa. That is from my side, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Okam. Let me hand over now to Honourable Mulivikane.
Thank you, Chairperson. My apology, I'm on the road to Parliament. But I just want to check with COSATU that for them being aware of the very high rate of unemployment, what is their opinion on the issue of addressing the 70 billion owed by the municipalities to Eskom without negatively impacting the process of the poor households and those who can't afford due to the increasing unemployment and poverty? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Is there any other hand? Lubabalo?
No, Chairperson, there's no other hand.
Okay, we only have two. Honourable members, I think when we dealt with the first session of presentation, I requested that we need to look on both sides and come with solution, be part of the solution and not just identify problems without proposing solutions. Maybe let me just say, start by appreciating and welcoming both presentations from COSATU and Dear South Africa. The reason I'm raising this that to be rigid, and I know it's something Honourable Okam is very adamant and different on the issue of privatization, that he doesn't see anything else that can resolve the issues of Eskom except for it to be privatized. And unfortunately, I don't subscribe from that school of thought, and I disagree with you as a member. Honorably so, that I don't think the issue of privatization is going to resolve the issue of load shedding and the problems that we are seeing of corruption, all that within Eskom. What else do you think can be done? Because the responsible ministers, we have had them in the House, in the MCOP, even the Minister of Electricity, who have come with plans, who have spoken to us, who have raised questions. He has given you answers on how best you think, how best you think as government we can resolve the issue. So I also think that from our stakeholders, the partners who have made presentations here, you are free and welcome to also make your proposals to relevant departments, even to the president, as to how do you think, as a responsible citizen, how do you think we can resolve the issue of Eskom? I want to appreciate the presentation and the extent at which Dear South Africa has gone in making sure that you involve more people, because public participation to us is very core as the oversight body. So we want to appreciate that. Before I hand over to you, both COSATU and Dear South Africa, I will request Sakasi to check if we still have the quorum before we go to the next item while you are responding. I'll start with the comment matrix.
Sure, no, thanks, Chair. I think thanks to members for the questions. I think all of us basically, I think, have the same vantage point. We've decided a few ideological issues, but I think to Honourable Ocamp on the issue of the debt relief conditions. So we agree with Treasury that there has to be a focus on maintenance. That's the quickest, the most effective way of ending load shedding. We can't afford for half of our grid capacity to be collapsing all the time. That needs to be ramped up, etc. But where we disagree with Treasury, that we need to also enable Eskom to transition to more modern, more efficient generation capacity. That means they need to be allowed to invest new generation capacity. So we can't understand the logic of simply prohibiting them for this time to do so. We think we have proposed with Eskom Social Compact that we really need to escalate the fight against corruption, wasteful expenditure of an Eskom, because it is bleeding us from dry. We all know the horror stories, and those are really honestly just the tip of the iceberg. We know the issues of criminality have become entrenched in Eskom at all levels. And at times you have to deal with criminal prosecution to uproot some of those elements. Otherwise, you're not going to fix it. And I think, Chair, that's why we feel that we need to do better by Eskom as well, because Eskom has tried to recover some of the stolen money from some of these companies, but they need to prosecute, and Eskom can't prosecute. So we really need to see the police, the NPA, SIU, Hawks, etc., taking the issues of Eskom criminality much more seriously. So we also think, and so it's correct that Treasury said we need to move to prepaid meters. That's what we've been calling for. But we need a plan to do so. We don't need just to say a broad wish list of prepaid meters. We need to have a serious plan where we move to prepaid meters. Otherwise, Eskom is going to remain forever dependent upon bailouts, and that's not going to be sustainable. We have to have a much more coherent plan around debt collection. It can't be right that every year Eskom loses about 20 billion rand in terms of its shortfalls, yet we have about 57 billion rand in rising moved to Eskom by across the country, but in particular municipalities. But shall we also think that, you know, part of fixing these fiscal leakages is then also enabling Eskom to move towards more affordable tariffs, and the tariffs have to be based upon clean costs. It can't be based upon including accommodating corruption, mismanagement, etc. On the issue of new generation, look, I think we all agree that Eskom does need to be supported in moving towards less carbon-intensive energy generation capacity, number one, for the climate change issues, but also to help Eskom itself reduce its maintenance costs. Newer plants will be more efficient, but also they'll be easier to maintain, they'll be quicker to bring on board, and so forth. It does mean also Eskom needs to be given support to expand its transmission and distribution network, because right now, some places like the Northern Cape, it's become saturated, and that's also now creating an additional problem as we seek to bring aboard new generation capacity. We think, Chair, there's an ideal opportunity for us to say, can we also support community-owned generation capacity, worker-owned generation capacity? It shouldn't simply be the private sector alone who enters the space. We would also want to see Eskom entering the renewable energy space as an owner as well, not just simply as a procurer. On the issue of the ring fencing of electricity bills, so we understand the issue, but I think that there's some unintended consequences to it as well. But we need to manage the different moving pieces, because many municipalities use Eskom or electricity tariffs rather to cross-subsidize other municipal services. Many of these municipalities simply lack a sustainable rates base, especially the ones who owe Eskom money. So it does need to say, okay, if we move towards making sure everybody pays Eskom directly, how can we then supplement that loss of income to municipalities? It does mean a new funding model. I don't think Cocktail, Salga or Treasury have been taking this issue seriously enough. And it doesn't mean that we must also begin to consolidate some of the municipalities, because to be honest, we can't sustain 259 mayors, mayoral committees, municipal managers, etc. Some of them are just simply, the towns are too small to sustain them. On the issue of scrap metals, Chair, no, I mean, we agree with our point. We're not saying permanent ban, but a temporary ban. That's the whole point of it, to give some breathing space to, one, to try to clamp down on the cable theft from a law enforcement perspective, but also for government to engage with the metals traders on how to regulate this sector, because, yes, there are legitimate ones who provide a service of recycling metals, etc., but we need to have a regime where they can require the people who bring in the metals to disclose, to verify the source of origin. It can't be correct that we're allowing criminals to strip cables from our public infrastructure at huge costs to the economy, even to lives. And there's no questions asked to these dealers. It also doesn't make sense, Chair, that we have more copper exports from the country than our copper mine produces annually. We think, Chair, there are positive examples in the city of Cape Town, whether it's the law enforcement front, where they've got this copperhead unit, which has done quite well in terms of dealing with criminal elements in this sector. But we need to have that position where we begin to regulate the trade, not to allow simple Wild West to continue. And then, Chair, just to Honourable Malatane, money's owed to Eskom. So we think it's a misnomer to say that it's only poor people who owe money to Eskom. We've seen, I think, many of the reports that some companies, hotels in Tshwane, a Nigerian consulate in Johannesburg, or many government departments and SOEs themselves owe a significant amount of money to Eskom. So it's not just a question of the poor. So those ones who have money and can afford to pay, so must be dealt with very harshly and must pay immediately. We think that there's a need to look at the debt. What is recoverable? That must be chased after. What is not recoverable? Find your write it off. But then as we make sure you plug the holes, we then move towards prepaid meters, because we can't afford to have this constant bleeding at Eskom all the time. The state can't afford a 254 billion rand bailout every year. And of course, that's money that could have been used to build hospitals, pay the police, fix the schools, roads, etc. To which, Chair, we think for the indigenous households, we really need to have a discussion with Cocktail and Salga about making sure they are registering all indigenous households and all of them are receiving their free electricity. And if we can all move towards prepaid, that means that we can increase the free electricity allocation to legitimate indigenous households, because the 50 kilowatts and 70 kilowatts, of it varies, isn't enough, definitely. But if everybody pays, that gives us more space to help the poor. So it's a question of also the rich paying as well. But Chair, we think currently the situation of 60% on prepaid, 40% pay later, that's not sustainable. It's breaking the system. And often poor households are paying their money to municipalities who then sit on the money and divert it. But if we don't plug the fiscal holes, Eskom will collapse. That will plunge the economy into further chaos. That will increase unemployment. But if we can fix the holes, fix Eskom, the economy does grow. As we saw last year, unemployment will fall like we saw last year. It fell by 4%. Of course, it also means Eskom reducing its own generation costs, tackling corruption, wasteful expenditure as well, because these all have a cascading effect. And I think just lastly, Chair, to yourself, so we had raised issues at COSATU with the Alliance in 2019, with the presidency. We had met with Cabinet 2020 on it, and hence the Eskom Social Compact. And even the debt proposal itself, Chair, which we received a lot of flack for from some political parties. I won't mention one political party in Parliament in particular, but we thought that this is our contribution, saying how can we assist Eskom, how can we assist the state to trying to rebuild Eskom, which is the lifeline of the economy, because our members depend upon it, and also because society as well needs it. And we appreciate, Chair, the point that you've raised, that we must all contribute towards solutions, because government on its own will never have enough capacity to resolve them. And all of us are part of the problem, and we're also all part of the solution. If you don't pay for electricity, of course, Eskom is going to struggle, and we'll all pay the consequence. So I think that's been our approach as COSATU. Obviously, how could we try to help assist government to rebuilding Eskom and the economy and so forth? But, yeah. Let me stop there, Chair, and apologies once again for talking a bit long. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Comrade Matthew. No need for our key diving. Let me appreciate the inputs that you have made and your responses. Hope you have responded responded adequately to all the questions or concerns or clarity that have been forwarded to you or directed to you. Dear South Africa.
Thank you, Chair. To address Honourable Alkem, I do support your notion as well that privatisation is essential. We've seen privatisation or semi-privatisation in other state-owned entities such as Telkom, and it has certainly produced good results within there. Maybe not at first, but it certainly has. It has changed a failing state-owned entity into something that is viable and investor friendly. We're already seeing privatization in one form or another within Eskom, with the increase in the limits on embedded generation, allowing private companies to increase their own capacity. I think it was from one megawatt up to, well, I think it's unlimited now. It was first 100 and then now it's unlimited. That's a good move. That's a good move. That is a move towards privatization. Maybe not in totality of Eskom, but it does allow other players to enter the field and to create competition. Competition is always good in the sector. It doesn't push prices up. It tends to decrease prices and increase efficiency and reliability. I know there's always a concern around a privatization creating a monopoly. It's not the case at all. As we've seen, there are really a number of independent producers, and that number is increasing due to the incentives now involved. At the moment, Eskom is the monopoly. So we have to look at it. We have to look at it that way, and that, in my opinion, is why we're seeing a rampant increase in prices, unfettered corruption happening in place, and a lack of transparency and accountability, because the Eskom is a monopoly. You talked about conditions that are attached, or that I'd like to see attached. I think there are quite a few. Too often we've seen bailouts going to state-owned entities and Eskom in particular, but there's a lack of understanding or public knowledge as to where the billions of rands and taxpayers' money ends up. Eskom says they need a bailout of 20 billion. Treasury allocates it from taxpayers' funds, but there doesn't seem to be any reporting as to how that money is used. In this debt relief bill, perhaps one of the conditions or few of the conditions should be around private auditing of the funds, of the allocations, and of the usage of those funds. As the bill has clearly stated, and the minister has as well, that the funds and this debt relief bill is based around repairs and maintenance of the fleet, and will be used there for that, as well as settling upcoming debt and loan repayments. And as it comes to repairs and maintenance, I think the private sector must be involved in auditing the repair and maintenance quotes, auditing the receipts and invoices, and oversight of the operations involved in the maintenance and repairs. As we know, there have been many reports, including Zondo reports and others, on the excessive expenditure on items. There was a mop, the whole story on mops, a single mop was charged at a ridiculous 50,000 rand and above. That will continue if there isn't any private sector oversight into these processes. And it's incredibly easy to overcharge in these sectors, and especially in maintenance and repairs, where you don't have competent staff that know how much these processes and items should cost. We have many competent individuals in the private sector who could play an oversight role in that, And I think that should be one of the major conditions attached to the ESCOM debt relief bill. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, dear South Africa. It's just unfortunate that we are now going to debate based on ideologies and our beliefs. But I think what we have done, we've heard what the public or the South Africans are saying. In terms of the ideology, of course, we are not sharing the same ideology. But then we also look at who will benefit, whose constituency is going to benefit from that, or who represents which constituency. So from the constituency that I'm representing, I don't think privatization is something that they agree with, but it's fine. We'll take the discussions further. We are going to have next week. We are going to have the Treasury to respond to the discussions and all the issues that have been raised. You are welcome to come and listen, join, and hear what the Treasury is saying. I also want to appreciate your time that you have taken from your busy schedule to come and join us, share with us the idea and do the work that represents the interests of the citizens of this country. Thank you so much, and until we meet again. We will now deal with the in-house matters. Lubabalo, thank you very much, dear South African Comrade Matthew. You can now be released. Lubabalo?
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Chairperson. Yeah.
Yes, can we continue with the minutes? Are we in the position to deal with the minutes?
Yes, Chairperson, but we are at the moment of the commission. We can divert the minutes to next week, Chairperson, since it appears that members are traveling to Parliament already.
No, we are already at Parliament. We've been having the meeting, running the meeting while traveling. So, members, can we please finalize this? It's just one set of the minutes. Can you do that, please, members? Honorable Okam, can you do that?
Chairperson, I've got no problem with that. It's fine. We can do it.
Okay. I said, can you reply to the next thing?
They are on the screen, Chair.
Okay. Page 1. Page 2, are you not on page 2 now? I'm using a
phone. Correct, Chair.
Yes, page 2. Page 3. Yes. Page 4. Right now, page 5. Can you go on the mountain?
Page
6, Chair. Page 3. Move.
Page 7, which is the last.
This is the last part of the minutes. Can I get a mover for the adoption of the minutes as a true reflection?
I move, Chairperson.
Thank you. Is that Honorable Okam?
Yes, it is.
Yes, thank you very much. Can I get that? Get a second up?
I second, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Moss. With that, Honorable Members, thank you for your understanding that we had a long meeting, but you were able to stay within the meeting and participated. Thanks very much. The meeting stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.